Radio's Davey D and Letters and Politics' Mitch Jezerich. This evening, we're going to give you an update about what's happened and what is happening on the ground here in Tampa. Of course, by now, many of you know, the RNC has been delayed by a day due to the hurricane. We're going to take you to Romneyville and then join housing rights activists as they occupied a foreclosed home. We're going to dissect weekend speeches by Tea Partiers and the religious right with Alternate's Adele Stan. And we're going to talk to Sakura Touré about what's happening right now in New Orleans and also about the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina within the context of the austerity and cutbacks central to the GOP platform that will be discussed over the next days. As Hurricane Isaac heads to New Orleans, we're also going to be talking with Jocelyn Gay. She is a Haitian-American activist. And Haiti, of course, they've had more than their share of hurricanes, including Isaac. But first, Mitch Jezerich, what's been happening with the weather?
Well, good. What is happening with the weather, right? That is the big question, Margaret. The events for the first day of the RNC, as you have already indicated, have been postponed due to fears that Tropical Storm Isaac may crash into Tampa. It never did, and all it has really brought is some sporadic rain.
So it wasn't even
wind.
A hurricane. It was just a storm.
Well, it's still a tropical storm. However, the tropical storm expected to turn into a hurricane even after it passes Tampa, which it really has done now, is still playing havoc on the RNC. Now, the U.S. National Hurricane Center says Tropical Storm Isaac is forecast to strengthen into a Category 2 hurricane before it makes landfall somewhere between Florida and Louisiana. Margaret, you may remember in 2008, the RNC, which was then held in Minnesota, was postponed for a day as it a hurricane then, Hurricane Gustav, was making its way through the Gulf Coast. Republicans worried about holding its convention while a potential disaster unfolded down south. Now, the hurricanes, both then and now, as you probably can imagine, make it much more difficult for the Republicans to distance themselves from President Bush and the President Bush administration's response to Hurricane Katrina, as they've been trying to do. The only one scheduled, really, from the Bush administration to speak at the RNC was Condoleezza Rice. Now, the breaking of the New Orleans levees will mark its seven-year anniversary this week. So with the path of the tropical storm Isaac currently heading towards New Orleans, Republicans are debating on how to proceed with this year's convention. There is some speculation that the RNC could be even more shortened than it already has been. Organizers still say, however, that tomorrow's scheduled events, including a speech by Mitt Romney's wife, Ann Romney, will proceed. Isaac is expected to hit landfall either late Tuesday night or early Wednesday morning. And as the storm makes its way northward across, or as the storm, as you know, has already made its way northward across the Caribbean and killed 21 people, at least 21 people, 19 at least in Haiti alone. Meanwhile, the RNC is officially underway. However, there was a ceremonial gathering in today of the convention, and then it adjourned just a couple of minutes later.
Well, Mitch, at least they're consistent, you know, 4 years ago, and here we are again having to delay by a day. And Davey D., you were out in some weather this morning, and, you know, there are reports that the weather also impacted the protesters, not only those, the official delegates at the RNC.
Right. I've been going to conventions since 96.
Mm-hmm.
And this is definitely the smallest turnout in terms of people who have been protesting. And that's something that veteran folks who've been out on the streets in various demonstrations throughout the years, they also noted that as well. Some of it is the weather. Some of it is also accessibility to Tampa and also massive security. I mean, this is a police state beyond police states. Over $50 million has been given to the city of Tampa, and they've done everything from buy brand new bicycles to new uniforms. You've seen a couple of armored new vehicles and, you know, all types of surveillance cameras. And so you're looking at a police presence that easily outnumbers the number of people who want to speak a dissent dissenting voice, they're easily outnumbered by the police, who are in the thousands and seem to be very gleeful and running around and showing off their brand new toys.
Uh-huh.
So I think all that kind of contributes, and definitely the weather was raining today. There were tornado watches and warnings. There's a difference, in case people don't know. When they say a warning, it means that something's really about to break out. And so that's a byproduct of the hurricanes. And so I think all that kind of just added to the situation. But the protests that I did see and been a part of have been definitely spirited. You know, they haven't shied away from making sure that their voices are heard. One of the challenges that they have is the fact that the way that streets have been shut down, it's been in such a way that protesters are kept literally like blocks and blocks away from the actual event. So, for example, last night they had the opening cocktail party for the RNC.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were inside, you had no idea anything was going on. You had no idea when you went out. And, you know, I came in there with the press. We were all looking. And then we come to find out that 1,000 people were out there protesting in the rain. But we had no idea because the way things were blocked off. And just talking to people who live in St. Petersburg, which is where they had the cocktail party, there were plans to evacuate the entire neighborhoods. I mean, like, people get out your house and stay away for a weekend. So this type of exercise is something that I think we should definitely pay attention to, because the tradition of being able to protest is something that's been here since, you know, this country has been founded. And to see the types of steps that are being taken under the name of security and fear of terrorism or any other name that you want to put on those who want to express dissatisfaction is something that I think is unprecedented, where they are going all out and taking extraordinary steps that we used to just attribute to a place like China or, you know, communist Russia's, you know. So these are things that we should keep in mind for today's protest. And I'll let you all hear a montage that we put together in a second. There was a lot of people with a who's who, everybody from Medea Benjamin to Omali Ishiteli from the Uhuru movement, which is based out here in St. Petersburg. We had folks from New York, L.A. Everybody was out there and definitely speaking to the issues of the day. The main concerns is that there's been immense corporatization of the two parties. And so people aren't favoring one over the other. There's a war on women. There's a war on poor people. And those seem to be major themes that were resonating with folks. And they don't care if it's Mitt Romney or a continuation of the Obama administration. The issues that were raised at today's RNC march are issues that they're going to be confronting whoever's sitting in the White House for the years to come.
Both parties have the same contributors. There's banks, major banks, telling them, look, here's money for your campaign. Get your ad up and running. Get elected. We need you in office. Because when they're in office, then they cash in their favors. You can see it with Bush, and you can see it with Obama now. And you'll definitely see it with Mitt Romney. The fact of the matter is, a two-party system does not work. Because you're given two choices, and two choices can never work. It's not a point of being as simple as possible. It's a point of being as fair as possible.
Because both parties represent a social system that was born of genocide and requires colonialism and war in order to be able to maintain itself. We want to say that we believe and understand, as other peoples around the world who are fighting back and are responsible for the current crises that we see in imperialism today. We believe that it is imperialism that has to go. That yes, we are opposed to the policies of the Republican Party. We are opposed to its attacks on women, on gays, on lesbians and bisexuals and transsexuals. We are opposed to the attacks on immigrants by both the Republican Party, and the truth is that Obama's regime has kicked out more people from this country even than what Bush has done. We are opposed to those policies. We are opposed to what the Democrats and the Republicans have brought to Iraq, have brought to the people of Afghanistan, have brought to the people of Palestine, have attempted to do in places throughout South America. We are opposed to all those policies, but more importantly, we are opposed to imperialism itself.
And today, I bring a message that we intend to take this one-party system down in America. On Election Day, we need to occupy the ballots. And if they do not allow other viewpoints into the debate, we better occupy the debate. Both parties don't give a damn about us. Don't give a damn if we can feed our children.
This is supposed to be a nation of immigrants, right? Immigrants created this country along with the indigenous folks, right? And we got to acknowledge that Romney, his solution to immigrants is auto deportation. That is unacceptable, right? Are you with me? Down with deportations. We know that we have a lot to do with the current administration. We're demanding Obama full legalization, stop the deportations, right? But we know that the Republican National Committee, the leadership, and the Republicans have a total anti-people agenda, anti-worker, anti-woman, but especially they have an anti-immigrant agenda. Whether it's Arizona or Alabama, with their anti-immigrant legislation, outlawing immigrants, outlawing ethnic studies, outlawing the right to speak Spanish and be bilingual. The current Republican agenda is to get rid of us, to auto-deport us. We're not going anywhere, are we? We're going to stay here. We're going to build this movement. We're going to demand money for human needs and not for war. Are you with us?
Continue with our rally.
We will continue with our rally.
If you will.
Join us.
In front of the stage.
So there you have it. If you're just tuning in, this is Pacifica Radio Live from the Republican National Convention in Tampa. This is Davey D, along with Margaret Prescott and Mitch Jesuits. What you were listening to were just a little bit of sights and sounds, so to speak, of the early morning rally. You heard Carlos Montez, the founder of the Brown Berets. You heard Sherry Shankla, who is the vice presidential candidate for the Green Party. Did I mispronounce her name? Go ahead. Break it down for me, man.
Shankla.
There you go. And then we heard Omalia Shetelli from the Uhuru Movement. The two people that you heard that started at the beginning of the montage and ended it were folks that were very upset about what took place when the opening march went. What you had was a scenario where folks were led to a holding cage. And once people got there, they were like, what the heck is this? And so a march broke out and people were more spontaneous. And that's what brought about the type of police action and police presence. That's where you saw the bikes being rolled out and you saw the tanks and all the other stuff. People felt that being ushered into a kennel, so to speak, that was blocks away from the convention where nobody could see or hear was just unacceptable. And so that is kind of the situation at hand. I talked to a gentleman who was from Tampa, and he was pretty upset, and he explained that for almost a year they had made a lot of proposals to the local city council and to the local government about what sort of concessions needed to be made so that they can have a very fair exchange of ideas. And he said that none of these things were granted. They wound up having to break a police barricade. I saw that earlier today to make their point known. And so maybe if we have a chance, we can play what this particular gentleman had to say about the way the marches and the type of obstacles that were put in front of them that prevented people from really being able to do what they needed to do. So just give me 1 second as we kind of get this queued up. Okay, let's go. Let me ask you, what does your sign say?
It says, welcome to Tampa, home of the clean zone.
What does that mean?
Well, it means to me that I appeared before our city council and begged our mayor for 8 months to be fair about this set of convention rules that they put into place. And most of them weren't even interested in hearing me, and none of them did anything. None of them did anything so much as really return a phone call or make a motion before council to avoid a lot of the problems that we're having now, and that's not being able to get around. It's not being able to have good infrastructure and support. We had to beg for water. We had to just about break a police barricade a few minutes ago. And we operate under a special ordinance right now that was drafted as broadly as it could possibly be drafted. Nobody knows what it means. The police officers that tried to stop us just now had to phone in for orders and instructions when all we were making a request for was for water that had been provided for this very occasion.
What were some of the suggestions that you made before the city council?
To allow overnight camping under special restricted circumstances so these all of us protesters would have a place to perch during the convention that would be peaceful. The police would have been able to know who was going to be in place. They would have known who was going to be there. There would have been a light, real workable accreditation for and permitting process. And instead, they just left everybody their own resources in what turned out to be a near-miss hurricane.
It seems like the police have spent an awful lot of money on new uniforms, bikes, and the whole nine. What is that about, and they're asking for food right now, but how does that square with the things that you all were looking at?
They spent an awful lot of money on lining the pockets of clothing contractors and other people that benefited as a result of being awarded contracts under a $50 million grant from the United States Congress.
So $50 million came to Tampa Bay?
Correct.
Wow. Let me ask you, the people here, the fear is that, that there would be anarchy and outside agitators, and that's the excuse that they use from Oakland all the way to here. What's your response when you hear that sort of excuse for not allowing some of the things you probably propose?
There's anarchy every time somebody drives 56 miles an hour on the interstate. It's baloney. That's a lot of hype. These people were trying to meet, organize, assemble, and express in good faith, and they got tunneled around like experimental laboratory rats. They got put in a cage, not within the sight and sound of the delegates over by the convention venue. You couldn't hear a bomb in that parking lot if you were standing over at the convention center. They said we were going to be within sight and sound. If you have binoculars and if you have a public address system like the one that they use on the mall in Washington, D.C. on the 4th of July.
That's what I was going to ask you about. Whose idea was it to put people in the cage?
His Excellency the Mayor.
Isn't he a Democrat?
I'm sorry?
Isn't he? It doesn't matter.
Democrat? He's a Democrat in sheep's clothing. Yes, he is.
Well, I appreciate it, man, and thank you for clarifying what's going on here and seeing that, as you said, a lot of this could have been avoided if they had just really listened to reason.
And it ain't over yet.
There you go. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. So there you have it, just a little bit of what was going on this morning. Just to paint a picture, there are all sorts of marches and activities going on. Arianna Huffington is in town. She has a whole thing that's jumping off all week called Oasis 2012. We had Ron Paul. His people are out in full force today, about 1,000, 1,500 strong. They had a Ron Paul Fest today. Sherry Hunkler, and forgive me, Sherry, for mispronouncing your name. She had a big march today, a poor people's march. And so we want to check in with somebody who was actually at that particular march. It got a little hectic out there, and it is Dave ID from Indy Bay out in the Bay Area. Dave, welcome to our live coverage here on Pacifica Radio. How's things going with you?
Hey, Davey, I'm doing okay. A little tired. There doesn't seem to be enough time to sleep, but there's a lot going on. It's exciting, scary, all of that at once, I suppose.
Talk a little bit about the march today, the Poor People's March. Was the weather a deterrent for you guys? I know it wasn't really too much of a deterrent this morning, but more rain was coming as I was going into the studio and you guys were getting ready to take to the streets and do that afternoon march.
Yeah, the weather wasn't really an issue. There was some rain sort of towards the end of the rally with the speakers at Romneyville. There was a torrential rain, but that was sort of what ended it wasn't even really a standoff. It was just an enormous show of force by the area police. They decided to stop the march.
Talk a little bit about, one, the police presence, and for people that are listening, they heard the name Romneyville. Can you explain to the listeners what is Romneyville here in Tampa?
It's a small tent city. Organizers from the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign leased some land behind an Army-Navy store, and they set up camp there. That was, you know, going to be the base of operations. It's, you know, in a sense, like an Occupy camp. The police didn't like the tents going up, and then they pressured the landlord, and the landlord asked them to leave, but they resisted. And the way the legal process works, since they are a legal tenant, they signed a lease. They can't be evicted for something like 30 days, so essentially they get to stay until the RNC is over.
You know, the other thing is, you were talking about the police presence. A couple of things. Talk about the number of police that have been out there, and also the crazy rules that have been put in place. For example, you couldn't really carry an umbrella. They consider that a pole or a structure. They said you couldn't have gas masks and all sorts of things, but you can carry a gun within the perimeter of the RNC, which is just, you know, it seems counterintuitive to a lot of people listening.
For sure, for sure. Yeah, you can carry a loaded weapon with a permit, but you can't have a piece of string or rope that's longer than 6 feet, or a stick that's more than 2 inches wide. I think it's just part of the big clampdown. You know, I was at the RNC in 2008 in St. Paul, and it's a different story here. They figured out, they're getting smarter about it, and they figured out basically how to make it a ghost town. One thing a lot of people don't talk about is, just the parking restrictions. You can't park anywhere downtown right now. So, you know, there's not a lot of public transportation as far as I've been able to tell. And so it just makes access really, really difficult. It's sort of a police state with a smiley face in a way. You know, for the most part, you know, the officers act nice, and I think they're on instructions under, you know, orders to put on their best face. But, you know, they showed really what they were all about today. And I've been stopped and asked for ID while I was walking around downtown photographing, and I saw two people temporarily detained by DHS today for the same thing.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that those who want to get their message across to the folks that hold so much power that are in these convention centers here at the RNC, the type of street protest that we've seen over the years, is that effective, or is there another tactic that needs to be used at this point in time?
Well, I don't know. I think things evolve, you know. I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, I'm not aware of, like, a large protest movement here. A lot of the other RNCs have been held in cities like, you know, Minneapolis, St. Paul, New York, that have larger, decades-long protest movements. I think that makes a difference. You know, they're upping, you know, the feds who are sort of running the show are upping the ante, and I think it's up to demonstrators and protesters to, you know, to react and move on. It's sort of a back and forth, you know, that there's lessons learned on both sides as you move forward.
Right. As we get ready to close out, Dave, from Indy Bay, how can people see some of the work that you all are chronicling? And also, are there any major events that you see coming up that we need to be aware of?
Okay. To follow the coverage that videographer friend and myself are doing, you can go to indybay.org. That's IndyBay.org/ capital R, capital N, capital C, 2012. That's indybay.org, RNC 2012. We're putting all of our video and photos and reports there. As for what to follow, I've actually found that the best calendar is at resistrnc.org. You can go there, and they list almost everything. You can go to a couple other sites to find things here and there. Tonight there's a roving dance party, I guess, if the weather holds out. That should be interesting. That starts at 11 p.m. at Centennial Park. And it's pretty much nonstop. You know, the people down here have done a really great job despite the adversity that law enforcement authorities are throwing in their faces, and the city council and, you know, the local politicians as well.
Well, Dave, we appreciate that. What we're going to do is I'm going to bring Mitch back into the conversation, Mitch Jesuits, because he wants to talk a little bit about these home takeovers. And we want to thank you for joining us on our live coverage from the Republican National Convention. That's Dave ID from Indy Bay Media. Mitch, what's happening?
Well, Davey, over the weekend, housing activists who were camped out at Romneyville for the past few months went into a Tampa neighborhood full of abandoned houses and moved a homeless couple into an empty house. Now, local activists were joined by national activists when this occurred. Last I checked in, the couple is still there. In a moment, we're going to even have more on Romneyville. But first, I went out to that takeover of the home, and here's some of what happened.
Well, people who were at Romneyville have come to this house, an abandoned house, and have now occupied it, taken it over. In fact, I'm now here with two people who will be living here, a married couple. Tell me your names.
Elijah Super.
Tell me about this house. What happened? How long ago did you get here?
About 10 minutes ago.
Tell me about what it means for you.
Come out to help folks get this house. Yes. My name is Life Malcolm. Life Malcolm.
You're from Tampa?
Yes, born and raised in Tampa.
Tell me about this tour you just gave.
So the tour, what we see for the Republican National Convention is the mayor and his administration has been talking about how Tampa's going to be on the world stage, and they got $50 million or so to beautify Tampa to present it to the world. The thing is, though, the truth of the matter is Tampa is not being presented to the world, just the part of Tampa is being presented to the world. Like the Bay Shore area, Davis Island area, the downtown district, and what have you, Channel Side district. But not East Tampa, Sulphur Springs, West Tampa, the most neglected areas of the city. And so we got together with a band of journalists and media persons and took them around to show them the Tampa that Mayor Bob Buckhorn and the rest of his administration does not want the world to see. It's an area flooded with foreclosed homes, abandoned homes, dilapidated land, overgrowth, overpopulated with homeless people, people who are in obvious economic distress. And so, you know, we took people on a tour of that Tampa.
Of that Tampa. Who came on your tour? Was there CNN, Fox?
No, CNN didn't show up. Fox didn't show up, though I'm quite sure they were invited. However, people from local newspapers came out, and some other, I don't remember, but there were several press people.
There's press here.
Yeah, definitely.
But none of the major networks.
Right. They don't want to cooperate with pulling the skirt up on the real Tampa. So
I'm now joined here by Sherry Hunkala. Sherry Hunkala is the vice presidential candidate with the Green Party. Sherry Hunkala, thank you for your time. And as you were mentioning earlier during the press conference that you and your running mate, Jill Stein, have been arrested before of taking over buildings. Is this a campaign strategy for 2012?
Well, you know, for me, it's a life strategy because I've been doing this for 25 years now. But it was the first time that my running mate, Jill Stein, had ever been arrested. And I think it was an incredible statement. You know, Dr. Martin Luther King used to say, sometimes we have to act like the ambulance drivers and go through the red lights. And on the question of throwing men, women, and children out onto the streets of this wealthy country, I think it's high time that we ignore those red lights, that we go through them.
Is this type of action a new phase of this type of movement?
Absolutely. Across this country, on every day, in some community, people are beginning to move themselves into abandoned properties, or we're in the process of convincing the million families that are slated for foreclosure this year just to stay in their homes.
You're also founder of Poor People's Economic Campaign.
Yeah.
What is making you run for vice president here?
You know, at one time in my life, you know, it's been a long journey for me to get to the point that I'm at right now. I never wanted to get involved at all in electoral politics. But then if I really believe in things like housing families, I really had to understand that without some kind of independent political motion in this country, then all we're doing is building one big coalition. And it's a really important thing to do movement building, but it's another thing to be serious about gaining power in this country. And separate of us building some kind of independent political motion and cutting our chains from the Democratic Party, we are going to continue to watch people go to war and kill each other.
And again, that was Sherry Hunkela, vice presidential candidate at a takeover of a vacant home over the weekend. We'll be right back. And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the Republican National Convention in Tampa. Now, for more on what's happening in the streets of Tampa, I'm joined by Reverend Bruce Wright. Reverend Bruce Wright is with also the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. He's also a local activist here in Tampa. Reverend Bruce Wright, thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
You are also staying at Romneyville.
Correct.
Tell me, what is Romneyville? And when I hear Romneyville, I think of the old Depression era Hoovervilles.
Well, you got it right on the head there. That's exactly what we're trying to do with Romneyville, is to express the same kind of sentiment that existed with the Hoovervilles in the 1930s. When the Depression happened, Hoover put lots of families on the streets, and encampments began to appear. Many people are familiar with that from Steinbeck's book, Grapes of Wrath, and even the movie that Henry Fonda starred in back in the 1930s. And the whole notion of it is to, with these things such as Romneyville, and we've done it at all the previous conventions over the last several years, is to underscore the problem of poverty, homelessness, and unemployment, and to look at the whole crisis we're in right now. Our own state here, Florida, has one of the highest foreclosure rates in the country. It's in the top three, one of the highest unemployment rates. And being the third most populous state right now, it becomes a very, very serious issue. This state is increasingly becoming almost like a giant, if you will, Hooverville. And so we felt like it was important to make a statement at the Republican convention, and we intend to do the same at the Democratic convention, calling that Obamaville, to make a statement to the public that poverty and homelessness can no longer be ignored. Too often in the political discourse of both parties, poverty, the P word as we call it, is almost considered a cuss word, or something that people ignore, because it is not something that's at the forefront of people's minds. And so we're here to make it at the forefront of people's minds.
Well, I hung out with you a little bit on Saturday at Romneyville. A lot of people are homeless staying at Romneyville. How has this convention affected people who are homeless? I remember being there, and we were given a map that some folks were saying they're at a shelter, and that there were streets marked saying that if they were to walk on these streets, they would be arrested. I don't know how accurate that was, but that was at least the perception that these folks had.
Well, to some extent, there's truth to that. The police have been a very intimidating, occupying force with poor and homeless people. And not only the homeless and poor in general, communities of color we know in our city have been impacted by this. And so there has been this concerted effort to remove the face of poverty out of visible sight of the Republicans and of the national press.
Yeah. Romneyville began in May?
Yes.
When I was there, it reminded me of an Occupy encampment. And, of course, there's Occupy Tampa as well at a different location. Is this an Occupy encampment?
No. In fact, it's much different. We've been doing land takeovers and encampments for years. In fact, we've had them in our own Bay Area. We had
And you mean the Tampa Bay area.
Yes, Tampa Bay area. You got to get that right.
From
I know.
The area in San Francisco.
And in the Tampa Bay area, we had a homeless encampment a few years ago that the police attacked and literally slashed the tents in half. It made international news. There were homeless people in these tents. And this is their homes. I myself have been in and out of homelessness, so I understand this situation. And what is most frightening to me is that in our city, churches and religious institutions seem to have found the ability to welcome the Republican convention, such as a mega church called The River, hosting a Tea Party event, which is disgusting to me and totally contrary to the faith I understand that Jesus preached. But secondly, two churches in town, and I'm naming them because I'm really not afraid to name names. That's people that know me know that's how I am. St. Andrew's Episcopal Church and Sacred Heart Catholic Church opened their doors to law enforcement, to let them be staging grounds for law enforcement. And that, to me, is disgusting and sick. And this is endemic of not only the Republican Party, but the people in power and how they have such disdain for the poor.
I went to the mega church, The River, last night for the Tea Party.
Oh,
that was really something. We're actually going to have more about that at 9:30 Eastern on our broadcast. Reverend Bruce Wright, what is the future plans then for Romneyville? You mentioned you're going to go to the North Carolina, to Charlotte, for the Democratic Convention, but will Romneyville here stay?
We have until the 17th at that property. What we're doing is trying to create another spot to continue Romneyville, or whatever it may be called, depending on what happens. And we also are looking at more housing takeovers. We have been able to place one family, the Poor People's Campaign has, as you know, you just reported on that. And we want to continue to do that because we think there needs to be a national movement, and the campaign has been spearheading that kind of movement for years, to take over abandoned houses. Foreclosed on bank-owned houses and put people back in it. In fact, put the very families that have been foreclosed upon back in those houses.
Do you anticipate that the married couple that you put into the house on Saturday are going to be able to stay there long?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, there's been a lot of press coverage. There's a temporary moratorium, but that may have been called more for weather conditions on any kind of eviction or foreclosure. We do know that if a residency is established, there's going to have to be an eviction process anyway. But our hope is to, at some point, negotiate with the powers that be, i.e. Chase Bank, and basically appeal to their sensibility. This property was a blighted property. It was bringing down the neighborhood, and it was potentially being used at times as a crack house. So the reality is, it's to their best interest. And they've already been paid for the house. Let's be honest. The banks have been bailed out to the tune of billions of dollars. As far as I'm concerned, they've already got their money on the house.
Reverend Bruce Wright is with the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, also staying at Romneyville, and you'll be in Obamaville in Charlotte next week.
Yes.
All right. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Again, you are listening to Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the Republican National Convention in Tampa. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Now, there's some speculation over whether authorities will use drones for surveillance over Tampa during the RNC. Federal officials say unmanned drones will not be patrolling downtown skies and streets during the convention. However, the Tampa Tribune reported earlier that a company that builds drones planned to outfit small unmanned helicopters and ground vehicles with cameras and operate them on behalf of unnamed government agencies during the convention. Now, Tribune executive editor Richard Moss released this statement on Friday about this story. He said, quote, "Federal and local officials responsible for RNC security have responded to our front page story today saying that they have no plans to use of drones over the skies of Tampa during the convention." Continues, "This is in direct conflict with Kurt Winter, an employee of United Drones, who told the Tribune reporter Howard Altman on Thursday, on Thursday's story. Then this morning, Mr. Winter called Mr. Altman back to say he misspoke regarding a statement he made yesterday about receiving a waiver from the FAA to operate the drones." The statement also continues, "Mr. Winter did not, however, back off from other statements he made on Thursday regarding the company's role in operating drones during the convention. We are continuing to report out the story. Now, whether or not drones will be used during the Republican convention, Tampa is a major center for the development of drones. Last week, Code Pink protested at the defense contractors Raytheon's corporate office here in Tampa. I spoke with Code Pink's Medea Benjamin, author of the new book, Drone Warfare, about the drone industry, as well as about Code Pink's vagina campaign here at the RNC.
Well, first off, what type of drone are we talking about? I guess it's like a miniature helicopter, and I assume that will be used for surveillance.
That's right, yes. Most of these drones, I mean, I assume they're not going to be shooting at us, the protesters, from drones overhead. So the other thing they do is surveillance. And, you know, they did use drones in the Nader protest in Chicago. So it's certainly not new to use them for crowd control. It's the first time in a convention. And it will just be one of the many other tools that they will be using for surveillance.
Tell me more about the drone industry and what Tampa represents for that industry.
We had a protest here on Wednesday about the drone industry here. And on Thursday, we were at Raytheon, which is making some of the new missiles for the drones, competing with the Hellfire missile, also making its own small drones, and making some of the cameras and the other kind of sensitive technology for the drones. Then there's Northrop Grumman here, there is Lockheed Martin, there is a company that produces propellers for some of the drones. There's quite a large drone industry here. Tampa also has a base for the Southern Command, and when you have these kind of bases, you find a lot of the weapons industry surrounding them.
CENTCOM is here.
CENTCOM is here, and there's also the McGill Air Force Base that is using drones. And the drone industry is just very excited about using drones for these kinds of protests and wants to show off its drone. And I think of the fact that also they are trying to use Tampa and the Florida area as one of the six national test sites for the testing of drones in general for opening up U.S. airspace. So in that sense, they want to show that Tampa is drone-friendly. One of the other connections locally is the university here. The University of South Florida is involved in drone research. It's one of the universities around the country that has some very large contracts with the Defense Ministry, working together with the Navy. And so it is one of the universities that is using the young minds of the budding scientists to come up with more of the drone technology. Now, some of this, they say, is being used for things like mapping the ocean surface, and that could be a very positive thing. So it's not necessarily that all of the research that the university is doing is for purposes of killing people. But the students are trying to find out more about what are all the connections with the Defense Department. The university has not been very forthcoming with that information.
Okay, one last question. When I first saw you before we began this conversation, you told me you had what? Boxes full of vaginas.
You said it on air first.
There's no shame in the word.
That's right. Vagina is not a four-letter word.
That's right.
And that's one of the things we're here to say, because the Republicans won't even let it on the be said on the floor of the State House in Missouri. And we think it's important. One of our big banners says, if you can't say it, don't legislate it. And we asked our Code Pink supporters around the country, we said, we know a lot of you can't come here in person, but send us your artistic representation, no photographs, please, of your vagina. And so we went and picked them up, and there are boxes and boxes of them, and we're anxious to see what people have sent in, and we are going to deliver them to the Republican headquarters.
Fantastic.
We also have some vaginas that are wearable, and our friends Pat and Sandy from...
Like a hat, or... What?
No, it goes over your head covers your, I would say, down. It comes down to my knees.
Oh, okay.
A little bit bigger than that, actually. Our friends Pat and Sandy from Emma's Revolution wrote a terrific song called Take Your Vagina to the RNC. I would recommend that your listeners look it up on YouTube because it's just a great song. And now we have a group called the Dancing Vaginas that will be doing a lot of dancing here at various venues of the RNC, especially one where Michelle Bachman is speaking, and there's a couple of other places where, that we don't think would be too vagina-friendly. We're going to take our friendly dancing vaginas there.
All right. I have a feeling we'll end up playing that song after this. Maria Benjamin, thank you so much.
Thank you. You'll love it.
Oh.
You're just tuning in. You're listening to the live broadcast, Pacifica, from the Republican National Convention here in Tampa Bay. This is Davey D, and you are listening to Medea Benjamin on a song. I don't know who that song is by, but it's a very uplifting song.
Mitch. Code Pink.
Code Pink. Yeah. There you go. And that is Mitch Jesuit, and also Margaret Prescott is in the building this evening. Joining us here in the studio is Rob Loray. Loray.
Loray.
There you go. And he is the News and Public Affairs Director here on the Pacifica affiliate WMNF here in Tampa. So you're in the center of the storm, so to speak, literally.
Yeah, really, for a lot of reasons. I mean, not just the hurricane, not just the RNC, but because the whole election could hinge on the vote in November here, too. So Florida's a big swing state, and this corridor that we're in, I-4, linking St. Petersburg and Tampa to Orlando, where at least in the Tampa Bay area, about 25% of the state's population lives, this could decide the whole election.
You know, with that in mind, one of the things that we didn't really hear a lot of people talk about today at the rallies that I've been at was voter suppression. And this state has a crazy history all the way back to 2000 up to now. Yeah. Talk about that. What is going on here in Florida?
Well, as Greg Palast famously reported in 2000, that people who had names similar to convicted felons were purged from the voting rolls back then. So even if your name was close, the state put you off the ballot. We are so regressive here in the state of Florida because we have not come to the point where we allow people who have served their time to vote in elections. And for a while there was some thawing about that when we had Governor Charlie Crist, but it's gone back to the old ways. But there's other kinds of voter suppression. We're way ahead of the rest of the country, if I could say that, when it comes to photo IDs. We installed that a few years ago. So, and there was not much protest. There was some by the League of Women Voters and the ACLU. Now we've got this thing where the last Sunday before the election, traditionally, the last few years, we've allowed people to vote. That is a big day for African-American voters. They go to church, and then they go vote on Sunday. Well, they've eliminated the last Sunday before the election. And, you know, as we've all heard, as you guys have been reporting on Pacifica, it's a way to suppress the vote, especially of minorities, suppress the vote of young people, too, because we require the voter ID. Some seniors that were born without birth certificates. So we've got it all right here in Florida today.
One of the things that is also unique about Florida and having done get out to vote work is that many people shied away from the state now because there are these new rules that could put you in jail if you start registering people to vote.
Well, I think the League and the ACLU are fighting back, and they're saying we're not going to let these rules deter us. The rule now is that if you sign somebody up to vote, you've got to turn that voter card in to the supervisor of elections office within 48 hours. That's being challenged in the courts, and the ACLU and the League of Women and voters and other voting rights groups are saying we're going to train our people, we're going to get it done right, and even if there is this 48-hour requirement, we're going to try to get this thing done because clearly the attack is on people of color and young people and some seniors.
When you travel around the state of Florida and you go to Miami and you come to a Tampa Bay and St. Petersburg, you see large numbers of people of color, Tallahassee, another place, Jacksonville as well. How is it when you have so many people from diverse backgrounds, how is it that this type of repression in Florida, the Sunshine State?
Well, that's a great question, and it all goes back to the way the districts were drawn. Tallahassee, which is our state capital, is lock-solid Republican, and has been that way for years and years, even though, as you pointed out, our state is very diverse, but Tallahassee doesn't really reflect that. You go to Tallahassee, and you look at the people that are sitting in the chairs, they don't look like the people in Miami, for instance, or right. Tampa. This state is really changing, but the state legislature hasn't kept up, in part because they've gerrymandered the districts.
Is there a movement on the ground to change that? And also, I would imagine, just having seen the reverend that was here speaking, there seems to be movements that go above and beyond the electoral politics.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, Bruce is a leader in those kind of movements. There was a movement 2 years ago to change the way we vote here in the state of Florida, to try to take some of the politics out of it, that the amendments passed that said, look, you can't gerrymander districts anymore, essentially what the amendments did, but the state legislature even this year got around it. So the new districts look very similar to the old districts. Mm. They are being challenged in court, but the court said, look, we're not going to change the districts before the November election. You guys are going to have to deal with what the legislature did. After November, then maybe the courts will weigh in and decide whether or not that they were drawn fairly.
Yes, and Rob Lauri, this is Margaret Prescott here. I wanted to ask you about the cleanup of the streets. I mean, we know there's a history where in cities where there are conventions, where prior in the weeks and even months leading up to the convention, there are crackdowns on homeless people, there are crackdowns on sex workers, anybody considered undesirable. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about how that has played out on the ground in Tampa.
Well, it's interesting because in the last segment you mentioned Sacred Heart Church. If you were to go down there, usually on a weekend night, on a Saturday or Sunday night, you would see lots of homeless people there on the steps of the church. They have disappeared. I can't say that I know where they've gone, whether or not the police have arrested them or whether or not they've just been, you know, our downtown, half of downtown is so militarized now. There are barricades. If you go south of Kennedy, you know, we're on a kind of a peninsula, sort of like the northern tip of San Francisco, but we're a much smaller peninsula, much smaller. So if you can imagine just a few square miles of that peninsula, and half of it is controlled by a National Guard, who are armed with rifles, is controlled by police who are wearing tear gas and all that. It's been militarized. So where those homeless people went, I don't know. There have been raids against some of the strip clubs. Here in Tampa. They've arrested people coming into this convention. At the same time, you know, it's kind of a running joke in this town because some of the people quoted who are strippers and others who work in this town, and this is a big town for that, were quoted in the New York Times. They said, okay, who are the best customers for you guys?
Right.
And the joke was, and it's very funny, that the Promise Keepers, which is a Christian religious group, last time they were in town, these workers had a field day. They were making a lot of money. But there was a raid just a few days ago in which some of the sex workers were rounded up.
Yeah, that's quite serious, you know, because we've seen this also in other conventions. And the word on the street is when the RNC comes to town, sex workers make a lot more money than when the DNC comes to town.
They
I don't
definitely
know what
get
that's
paid.
About. But, yeah, just one other quick thing. You talk about Florida being a swing state and being key in this election. A lot of the protesters that we have heard are critical of both the Obama administration as well as the RNC, and indeed some are even suggesting people not go out and vote. How do you think that presence, a protest presence, will then impact people on the one hand who are fighting voter suppression and on the other hand really have a case against both political parties and the political class?
Well, I'm not sure the people in the streets, and I think those are all well-meaning people, I'm not sure they really represent the people, you know, the majority of people. I think people think that there's a lot at stake at this election, and I think a lot of people are going to be motivated to vote on all sides of the issue, whether it's Green Party, Libertarian, Republican, or Democrat. And I think that kind of cynicism that you hear, I don't think that's reflective, though, of the general population. I mean, I think people are hurting. Their health care isn't working. Their jobs are sometimes being cut. Their pay is low. Their pensions are bad. And I think people think there's a lot at stake. So I most of the people I know are not sitting it out.
You know, with less than a minute left, we got to ask you, Stand Your Ground, Trayvon Martin, how will that weigh in this
in a scenario here in Florida, in Tampa, St. Petersburg.
Well, the Stand Your Ground law is really incredible here. And one of the papers went through and found how it has been misused, especially since Alec had it passed. I think the trial is going to be key. The tension was so high as whether or not George Zimmerman was indicted, whether that question was being debated. I think the interesting thing, Davey, is that one thing that's happened is that we have very liberal gun laws here in the state of Florida. People are allowed to carry, if they've gone through training, concealed weapons. In that event zone that you guys have been talking about, concealed weapons are allowed to be carried in, whereas bike locks or sticks or squirt guns are all being banned by the authorities.
Umbrellas, too.
Yeah.
You know, which I was surprised. I can carry a gun, but not umbrella.
Yeah, it's crazy. But we are so liberal and so pro-gun in this state that people can walk right through that event zone where there are going to be demonstrators, there's going to be a lot of people down there, and they can carry that concealed weapon. There doesn't seem to be a concern for public safety.
Yeah, another hot issue here in Florida clearly is the issue of immigration. And the immigrant community here a bit different than, let's say, in Los Angeles and some other places, because you have the large Cuban population, but there's also a large Haitian population as well. And as you know, the platform of the RNC, what they're saying about immigration, they're going to repeal what President Obama signed in terms of the Dreamers and the students who were lining up a mile long in Chicago to try to get paperwork. They're going to extend the wall. I mean, this is not exactly a platform that immigrant leaders think will really fly with any of the immigrant community. How is that playing out with the community here?
This is what I think. I think there's a sense of alarm within the Republican Party because some of the older hands in the Republican Party realize this is changing, and it could be the death knell for the party if they stand firm on that position. So people like Jeb Bush, and even to some lesser extent Marco Rubio, have been warning that if we don't embrace these people in some way, we are not going to have a future of a party. So in some ways, Jeb Bush, our former governor and the brother of the president, is on the outs with the mainstream Republican Party, because you're right, there is a hard line within that Republican Party. But what do you do when the country's changing? What do you do when so many people came here without the proper papers and then eventually became legalized? I think the smarter heads in the Republican Party say, look, we can't be that hard line. I mean, Tom Tancredo, who ran 4 years ago, there's not a breath of him. Nobody ever whispers his name anymore, even though he was one of the major players 4 years ago in the Republican run.
That's the voice of Rob Lori. He's the news and public affairs director here at the Pacifica affiliate, WMNF. Let me ask you a question, Rob, you know, if you can put on your political hat for a second. Former Governor Chris, I was going to call him Christie, thinking of New Jersey.
It's easy to make that,
right?
Yeah.
Endorsed Barack Obama, but many people forgot the senatorial election that involved Kendrick Meeks and Mark Rubio increased. Was there a deal being cut? Because they were trying to get Meeks to drop out the race at
famously,
one point.
Famously, we know that Bill Clinton called Kendrick and asked him to drop out. Kendrick Meek, being an African-American, he got 20% of the vote, and a progressive. He got 20% of the vote in that election. Was there a deal? Yeah, there probably was. They tried to arrange a deal. I don't think Kendrick bought into it. I think the thing about Charlie Crist, though, he will be forever remembered, I think, by many people for allowing felons who have served their time to have their voting rights reinstated. For many people, he was a hero for that, because that was not a popular position within the Republican Party. He's going to speak at the Democratic National Committee next week, at the convention next week, and he's going to come out. He's probably going to change parties sometime in the next few weeks. He is going to be a player in the next gubernatorial election here.
Well, I think we're going to get ready to wrap up. I got to say, man, you look like you could be the mayor. Does he not seem like he could be the mayor or something?
Yeah, I'm telling you.
I almost forgot him. Like, he's the news director, but he has that mayoral, you know, gubernatorial type of. Let me tell you.
Yeah, but David, before he runs out of here, though,
I mean,
Florida.
Can I buy a beer or something?
There you go.
Before you run out of here, Rob, Florida also a big state. I mean, this whole Medicare debate discussion.
Yeah. Oh, it's huge.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the polls that we've looked at say that seniors don't trust Paul Ryan's Medicare plan. So I think that they may have made a fatal mistake by doing that. So I don't think that Ryan is going to fly well. And a lot depends on the ads, though. A lot depends on the kind of selling job to the seniors in the next few months.
Well, that's definitely something we need to think about. We're going to get ready to wrap it up. I want to thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Steve.
And thanks for hosting us here at your station.
Thank you.
WMNF in Tampa. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back. Davey D, Margaret Prescott, Mitch Jesuits right here at our live coverage from the Republican National Convention in Tampa Bay.
And you are listening to 94.1 FM KPFA here in Berkeley and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 5:59. Stay tuned for more of the Pacifica National coverage of the Republican National Convention, and the Pacifica Evening News will return on Friday.
From the Republican National Convention in Tampa Bay, Florida. I'm Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth from KPFK in Los Angeles and from KPFA in Berkeley. I'm joined by Hard Knock Radio's Davey D and Letters and Politics, Mitch Jesurich. We are going to hear from a billionaire in the House. Is that right? Do we have a billionaire present? Felonious Acts.
It's time for This Billionaire Moment.
Felonious Acts of the Billionaires here reporting from Tampa. So they're postponing the opening of the Republican convention due to extreme weather. All of us big bundlers are hunkering down at the Westin Tampa Harbor Island Hotel. My security people tell me that some of those Occupy protesters have come out to try to vie for the attention of the media that we own. We'll stay nice and dry while they get drenched, which seems to be an apt metaphor for how the economy has been of late. Adelson has got the accommodations next to ours, and for a guy who's made his fortune in casinos, you'd think he'd be a little less grumpy about the stream of Tampa Bay's famous strippers coming in and out of our suites. We've been holding court for all the candidates covetous of our prodigious cash. This morning, the Tea Party Senate candidate from Ohio got on his knees in front of me and gave me the sweetest pedicure I've ever had. My toes are positively gleaming. I promptly wrote him a big fat token of my appreciation. Politicians offer the best return on our investment. A few thousand dollars for their campaign gets us legislation that puts millions of dollars of subsidies and tax breaks in our pockets. I've already put some millions of dollars into Restore Our Future, the Romney Super PAC. For that kind of cheese, I'm counting on the mineral rights to the whole state of Wyoming. Today was supposed to be the day when we paid lip service to the millions of social conservatives, fundamentalist Christians, Tea Partiers, anti-immigrant militias, birthers, Second Amendment activists who make up the meat of our coalition. I was looking forward to the Minutemen self-deportation ballet, as well as the Family Values Coalition's PowerPoint on how gay marriage makes every single traditional marriage seem like an exercise in futility. You see, we billionaires are less than a tenth of 1% of the population. We can't do it alone. If our candidates only ran on our issues, they'd get creamed, which is why we have to have them emit all those dog whistle signals to our foot soldiers on issues like gay marriage and abortion so they can get out there and vote for officials who will privatize the entire safety net and deregulate every corporate endeavor. We don't give a fig for whether or not a woman has the right to get an abortion. It's kind of a wash for us. If she's forced to give birth, we resent it if one of our policies covers her offspring, but we also welcome the arrival of another powerless peon to work in our factories. However, our social conservatives sure do care a lot. So the guys we're electing promise them to ban all abortions while they promise us to eliminate taxes on capital gains. When Mitt gets in and signs the bill that outlaws abortion, even in cases of rape and incest, my family won't suffer. I employ an on-staff physician who will take care of my daughter should the wrong person impregnate her. It's the same physician who grinds up the pituitary gland of an endangered species of pygmy antelope and injects it into my gluteus maximus every morning so I can feel as young as newly minted money all day long. Oh, I gotta go. Jackson's Bistro just delivered a bunch of their famous Key West conch fritters. I love food that's on the verge of extinction. This has been Felonious Acts of the Billionaires here reporting from Tampa.
This billionaire moment has been brought to you by thebillionaires.org.
Pick up the billionaire!
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the Republican National Convention. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and we're broadcasting live to you from WMNF, a Pacifica affiliate station in Tampa. We were originally planning on broadcasting today from the convention center, but as we have already told many of you, and as you probably already know, the first day of the convention has been postponed tomorrow. Tomorrow night, we'll also be coming to you at this radio station, and we will be coming to you from the convention center. Well, for more on what's happening around Tampa, I'm now joined by Mitch Perry. Mitch Perry is the news and politics editor at the local paper Creative Loafing. He was also former assistant news director here at WMNF. So, Mitch Perry, it's my great pleasure to welcome you back to your former studio.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Mitch. And Creative Loafing is the alternative newspaper here in the Tampa Bay area. I want to emphasize that.
In a weekly.
Indeed, actually, yeah, Newsweekly. How's it going?
Well, it's good to have you here. Mitch Perry, let me begin by talking a little bit about Ron Paul. What's happening about Ron Paul and his delegates? A lot of news, but not real clear news exactly.
Yeah, well, this could be interesting, Mitch. Tomorrow, the convention, of course, officially convenes at 2 p.m., and there is some, you know, little buzz that the Paul delegates will act up. And by that, that's because there's a proposed rules change. Ron Paul says his folks say they have more delegates than they actually have, which I believe is somewhere between 150 and 200. He got a lot of his delegates at these state party conventions, which are different than the actual caucuses or primary elections, right? Because if you think about it, Ron Paul was not really that successful. I know he did better than he did 4 years ago. He did better here in Florida than he did. It was still disappointing, you know, if you talk to a lot of the supporters. But then, not so much here, but in other states, they would have their election day or caucuses, but they would actually meet at their party convention a couple months later. And at those party conventions, the Paul people, seized those things and really kind of commandeered them and got more delegates there. So there was a proposed rules change that, again, they're going to talk about, bring up tomorrow, that would basically give presidential candidates veto power over their own delegates, which would really be a boost for the candidates and a reduction for states. If Romney didn't like a delegate slate to cast a vote in his favor of the convention, he could throw him out and choose an alternate. Ron Paul people are saying, this is, let me quote somebody here, this is actually Republican National Committee Chairman Jim Bopp of Indiana says, this is the biggest power grab in the history of the Republican Party because it shifts the power to select delegates from the state party to the candidate. So this could play out. Who knows? Maybe it'll die out in a few minutes. But it's something, you know, we all know this is pretty darn well scripted. And maybe this won't be tomorrow afternoon.
Well, the Ron Paul delegates and also Ron Paul supporters, thousands of them are here in Tampa.
Yeah.
Over the weekend, there was the Ron Paul Fest. You were there at the Ron
Paul. I was
there
on Friday afternoon. It just began hours into it. And I interviewed a handful of people, and they were all from different parts of the country, from Illinois, from Montana, from Tennessee, all believing in the cult of Dr. Paul, as they like to call him, the 77-year-old, who, of course, is retiring. This is really a swan song. So yesterday, it was really, it was great for him on an individual level to have cheering 7,000-plus at the University of South Florida Sun Dome. They came for him.
But that was different.
That was a different event.
Ron Paul never went to the Ron Paul Fest.
Yeah, I can't really get into the intricacies because I don't really recall them. Although the Ron Paul Festival was announced initially, actually, before the Ron Paul speech was months ago, they were going to have what they called Ronvoys coming from all across the country. People did come across the country. I never got the total number estimate at the Paul Festival, which is held at the Florida State Fairgrounds. It wasn't probably 7,000, which you actually had yesterday at the Sun Dome. But they did pipe in the speech, actually, Ron Paul's speech from the Sun Dome to the folks at the because it was sold out, basically,
yeah.
Although they weren't selling tickets, but it was filled up.
Well, we're going to hear some of that in a moment. But right now, Otis Clay, who is our engineer and also producer of this show, went to the Ron Paul Fest on Saturday, and he talked to a number of people who were there. Here's some of what they had to say.
I want to hear a round of applause for all the delegates for Ron Paul that are here. Come on.
Why do you hate the Republican Party?
They love the military and they love killing people, and
the
don't like that.
Party, no, we don't hate the Republican Party.
We just have some fundamental differences in how we manage our debt and with our foreign policy. We're spread too thin. It costs too much, and it ends up making our national security worse off.
I think we should absolutely legalize marijuana, and we need to focus on harm reduction rather than criminalization on all other drugs. Civil liberties, drug policy reform.
I don't hate the Republican Party. I'm GOP myself. I'm with the old GOP, like the Ronald Reagan GOP. This new GOP, like the Priebus is the chairman, he's got to go because he's steering the nomination process for the benefit of chosen few.
I like that there's a libertarian influence in the Republican Party now, so that makes me more of a Republican than a Democrat. We'd like to see more of both parties working for a liberty-oriented agenda. I mean, people's right to rule themselves, and as long as they don't hurt anybody else, they're allowed to live their life in whatever way they like.
Most black people are very unaware of politics beyond voting for Democrats. That's pretty much all that they've been taught all their lives. That's what was preached from my extended family. My parents didn't follow that. My parents were actually the first Republicans of either of their families. Got disillusioned with the Republican Party about the time that Bob Dole ran, and then about the time that I realized that George Bush was lying.
I don't believe in the Constitution, obviously. I do.
I don't hate the Republicans. I hate what they're doing. I think the Republican Party has been just as wrong about what their actual standpoint is as the Democrat Party has. So I wouldn't say I'm a Republican per se, but if the right candidate came to any party, I would support that candidate, not the party.
Because they're corrupt and because they put the party before the country, whereas a patriot puts the country before a party. They only want their good old boys then. They don't want any new blood. And the whole machine is so corrupt. We've got to break it.
You know, life is good. It's exciting. We are doing well. And people, particularly at the Ron Paul place here, understand the potential that, of course, we're here to celebrate Ron Paul. But after the Republican convention, we're all in the same family, and we're fully expecting that the Ron Paul supporters are going to understand this with Governor Gary Johnson.
Why do I hate it? Oh, well, because I was elected a delegate at my CD2 convention in Oregon. I don't know that you'd say I hate it, but I'm really disgusted with their corruption. Let's put it that way. I'm one of the contested delegates.
So, yeah, I'm a delegate from Maine. Yesterday I was serving on the RNC Rules Committee, and while I was making some remarks about an amendment to the rules to open our debates to, you know, guarantee access to candidates, they called me out and said, oh, you're a contested delegate. You're not allowed in here on the Rules Committee anymore. So I went next door over to the Credentials Committee, deciding at the time whether or not Maine should be allowed to be seated. A delegate on the Rules Committee from New Hampshire stood up and said, I oppose, you know, this amendment that would seat the Maine delegates, but it's very important that going forward we keep the young people involved.
Why am I here? For the music festival.
And again, that was a sound collage made by our engineer and producer, Otis McClay. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the Republican National Convention in Tampa. Tonight, we're broadcasting from Pacifica affiliate station, WMNF. I'm Mitch Jesuits, along with Davey D and Margaret Prescott. And we are talking to Mitch Perry. Mitch Perry is the politics and news editor at the local paper, a progressive weekly paper called Creative Loafing. And Mitch Perry is blogging a lot about the RNC, and you could check out his stories at cltampa.com. Mitch Perry, again, the fact that there were two separate events, there was the Ron Paul Fest that was at the county fairgrounds, or
right.
County fairgrounds,
yeah,
or state fairgrounds?
Florida State Fairgrounds, yeah. And then, right, and that was announced way back, I don't know, May or June. And Ron Paul, I don't know if he was ever actually contacted about this. These people were really well organized. Now, they told me, in fact, on this radio show, I have a radio program here on MNF on Thursday afternoons, some guy told me who was putting it together, they were going to bring 50,000 people to the Ron Paul Fest. That did not happen. We've had a lot of high estimated numbers about a lot of
things.
I've
heard more than 10,000.
Well, that's what you might have had, you know, almost had at USF, of course, yesterday. And there was, and there would have been more people, by the way. They filled up at USF a couple weeks ago, and there definitely, you know, was an overflow, and you could have filled out maybe the Tampa Bay Times Forum, which I think is really good. I know that Paul spoke 4 years ago, a similar type of thing at St. Paul. So, you know, his cult, again, you know, it just builds and builds. And, you know, I talked to a few people about Rand Paul, though. Obviously, his son, who's 49, he'll be speaking tomorrow night at the convention. And the theory always is that, of course, Ron played ball, basically, in the respect that he didn't go third party, if you will, because of Rand, you know, Rand being the heir apparent. But you talked to a lot of Ron Paul delegates. They love Ron Paul. They're kind of a little not so
they're
keen
not so
on
sure.
Rand. I mean,
yeah.
It depends, you know. But, I mean, it's not like he's other than he has
but
the
Ron
name.
But Ron Paul really didn't play ball. There was a lot of speculation
well, he didn't endorse,
that the reason
right.
why he didn't go to the Ron Paul Fest was because he wanted to avoid some of his extremist supporters. And that's why he didn't go there, and that he was expected in his speech last night to get behind Romney, which he did not do.
No, he didn't do that. He didn't endorse any. And you got to, again, the Ron Paul fans will tell you this is what, you know, he has integrity, you know, basically. He won't do that. He said he wasn't going to, whereas Rand Paul did endorse, you know. But again, Ron Paul, a lot of people wanted him to run third party. Let's think about that. You know, Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, spoke at the Paul Festival, the one at the Florida State Fairgrounds on Saturday. Ron Paul, who was in town, again, didn't do that, didn't run third party, stated with in the Republican Party, and you know, let's face it. I mean, he would have gotten more votes, I think, than Gary Johnson will, for example, who's got a bit of a following. And Gary Johnson is unhappy that he's never even put in these polls. His name isn't put in when they ask, you know, who do you prefer? You know, Obama, Romney, and what about, you know, name some third party candidates? So. So he's, again, you know, this is, but well, as we heard from the tape here, though, is as you heard some of these delegates talking about how some of them have been knocked out already. They're the contested delegates. And this, again, will come up tomorrow afternoon.
But it's very significant that Ron Paul didn't run as a third-party yeah. candidate. It's kind of like that Barry Goldwater 1964 moment of trying to take over the party. And this is what Ron Paul alluded to in his speech last night. Let's take a listen to some of that.
People at the convention were worried just how much trouble we would cause, and you generally have known what my advice is. Just stopping something for the sake of stopping doesn't achieve a whole lot, so I've been a little bit cautious. But what they have found out is they've overstepped the bound. There's a big fight going on, and we're involved in it, but everybody else, a bunch of them, are joining us and say, you've gone too far. The Ron Paul people were right about overstepping their bound. Ultimately, numbers do count. And even numbers do count when they don't count all the votes as well, because we do have the numbers. But those who promote ideas ultimately have to have an influence on the prevailing attitudes of the people. And that is what's happening today. The people now are waking up, and they're realizing the failure of what we have and the reason that these ideas are coming about. Now, in this primary, we had close to 2 million votes. They say, oh, yeah, there's 2 million votes. That doesn't swing an election. Da, da, da. You know, it's no big deal. But guess what? For every vote that we got in the primary, let me tell you, just from my personal experience of traveling around the country and meeting people at airports and wherever, the support out there is much, much greater, and they don't feel comfortable coming to a Republican primary. So the support there, I would say, be two or three times as much as the number of votes we got in the primary. We have talked a lot about the excitement that the young people bring, the excitement we've had on the campuses. Talk to close to 150,000 young people, enthusiastic. Were they the conservative college campuses, or were they the liberal college campuses? No, they were all the college campuses. They welcomed us. when you think if there's a party that says, oh, we have an open tent. We want new people to come in. We want to appeal to the young people. Don't you think they would be begging and pleading that they come into the big tent? Well, we'll get into the tent, believe me, because we will become the tent eventually.
And again, that was Ron Paul speaking at the Sun Dome last night. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the Republican National Convention in Tampa, Florida. And we are broadcasting today as the convention has been postponed until tomorrow, at least the events for the evening, from Pacifica affiliate station WMNF. And I'm Mitch Jezerich, and my co-hosts are also here, Davey D and Margaret Prescott. And also here with us is Mitch Perry. He is the news and politics editor at Creative Loafing, a weekly newspaper here, the progressive newspaper here, and you can find his writings at cltampa.com. Davey D, you've had some, you have a history with the Ron Paul people.
Yeah, I do. I've interviewed Ron. I've interviewed his son, Ran. I'm not really a big fan of Ron Paul, but I think within his movement, from my experience, because I run into so many people, there are different types of Ron Paul supporters.
Yeah.
And I think when he speaks, some of what you heard a few minutes ago, he says certain things that appeal to a large swath of people. And I think all of us need to pay attention because it's an indication with some of what he's talking about that how the corporatization of the two parties has blocked whole segments of society out of a process. That's something we need to pay attention to. Now, in terms of his politics and the whole libertarian thought and where that, you know, it's like, let's get rid of the Fed and people go, yes. And then it's like, and let's get rid of everything else along with it. You know, I don't buy into all that, you know, and that becomes a political difference that I have. But when I talk to a lot of folks, I run into two different types. I ran into one Ron Paul supporter today. If we had time, maybe we'll play his comments. I was like, you know, what do you think? You know, are you out here to support? And he goes, you know, well, Ron Paul should have been able to speak. It was short-sighted of the Republicans, but I don't support all this crazy stuff. The Occupy can go to hell and all that. So that's his position, right? And then you turn right around, and then you have some other folks that are walking right along with the protesters, and they're on the same page. And so, you know, you get kind of different strands of where people are going. But I think if you were to underscore it, there's a total dissatisfaction with what is going on right now, and they want some sort of change. And I think he has attracted a certain amount of people pretty consistently that want something different than what is going on currently. So with that being said, I think, you know, there needs to be more of an engagement with some of the people that are his, you know, folks that are with him. I don't think there's enough dialogue, and I don't know what that would lead to with the dialogue, but there's obviously some collective pressure points all of us need to be pushing on, and I don't think we do that. I don't think we take full advantage. His son Rand is a trip. Mm-hmm. You know, you talk to him, he seems to be like, we don't need no Voting Rights Act. We don't need no protection.
Rand Paul, I think Ron Paul thinks that too.
Yeah, but Rand is much more direct. You know, like I've talked to him, and he's like, you know, this, we don't need this. You know, you're just looking at him like, for real, man? He's like, yeah, we don't really need this. Voting Rights Act didn't do anything. So it's just like, okay, I get what you're coming.
Ron Paul says all that as well.
That's true. Yeah. And I'd be interested to hear what Mitch Perry, you know, your take on some of this, because during the election period prior to the convention period, a number of people on the white liberal left, I should say, were really in a bit of a dance with Ron Paul. Well, he's anti-war, and, you know, maybe we should really try to cut a deal with the libertarians. And then when the whole thing about civil rights came out, and like if somebody like myself or Davey D, you know, went to a restaurant or to stay in a motel, we could be turned away because of the color of our skin.
Yeah.
So there's that. And also the future now of the libertarian movement, because as you're saying, the young people, they're they're looking at Rand and they're saying, right. He's not his daddy.
That's exactly right. That's what I've heard from people. And, you know, going back to what you said about Ron Paul, when those newsletters came out, which, you know, was reported 4 years ago when he ran the first time,
yeah.
Then it kind of went away. And then when he ran again back, I remember December, you know, they came the issue. And Ron Paul never really had a really good answer for that stuff. He didn't really read the letters. He didn't edit them. It's kind of like the Dan Rather situation with, you know, Bush in 2004.
He didn't even have an answer when we asked him. I asked him point blank about the money he was taking from the Klan.
Yeah.
You know, and he didn't have an answer. Yeah. Then a conservative reporter followed up, and he didn't really have an answer for that either.
The answer I eventually heard there was that we're not going to deny money from anyone. Anyone's free.
Right.
You know, we're not supporting them, but if they decide they're going to give us money, we're going to
take follow-up
it.
Question was, do you approve of them putting your name on their site and collecting money in your name and associating themselves with you? And that's where the answer was like, well, I can't really control what people are. And people felt like there should have been a denouncement. They need to do that.
Excuse me. I will say this, you know, Paul has been deemed the godfather of the Tea Party, and I think to the people who were really Tea Party people and not just, well, you know, the Tea Party, the DNA of the Republican Party and Tea Party aren't that different, but there are differences, and there are hardcore Tea Party people. I went to a rally a week and a half ago when Paul Ryan was in Treasure Island, Pinellas County here, for a fundraiser a week and a half ago, and it was interesting because there's about 100 people, 75 anti-Paul Ryan Romney, 25 pro-Romney, and a couple of libertarians in the middle, literally in the middle of this thing. One of them was this guy named Alex Snicker, who ran for the U.S. Senate in Florida in 2010, and he looked over the Romney people to me, and he said, you know what, these are the same people with the Tea Party rallies I was at 2 years ago, and they bought into Romney, and he was really critical. And if you remember, the GOP primaries were kind of like Romney, or it might have been Huntsman, the establishment Republican versus the would-be Tea Party person, whether it was Bachman, whether it was Herman Cain, whether it was Rick Perry, etc. Romney always, you know, dominated that. Paul, you know, he had his little cult, but he was the other guy, you know, maybe would even get pushed up there. So true, I mean, I don't know, I don't want to call it true Tea Parties, but a lot of people think, you know, obviously true Tea Parties would not feel good about Mitt Romney. They never really will. That's why he continues to run so far to the right, Mitt Romney does, consistently to win their love. But I think that the people who are Ron Paul and are even some of the kind of the, you know, little out there and the Fed stuff, those are the hardcore Tea Party folks, you know, and those are the ones that won't vote necessarily Republican because they don't believe that Mitt Romney's serious about cutting the deficit down. For example,
I went to the river church last night, mega church, and I did talk to a number of Tea Party activists, and I was a little bit surprised that they were falling in line with Romney. They say that he wasn't great, but he's better than Obama. And what really energized them was the pick of Paul Ryan.
Right. Well, it's been a default system, right? That Mitt Romney's going to win those people because it's all about defeating Barack Obama. But it was not an easy ride. I mean, there was really no competition if you go back to it. Rick Santorum was the last man standing back in February. I mean, you knew this man was not going to be the next GOP nominee, right? By the way, his speech tomorrow night should be interesting.
Yeah, but, you know, there was Paul Ryan. I mean, he gave a shout-out to Ron Paul. You know, we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow on the floor in terms of Ron Paul delegates. I do think, my view is, Mitch, I do think they're going to fall in line because a lot of those people, even if they don't like Romney, it's we hate Obama.
Oh, they hate
and we
Obama.
Want to take our country back. So this is we want to take our country back vote. So I think they are going to fall in line here. And it's a little unclear to me then what happens to these thousands of people who showed up here at the University of South Florida in support of the libertarian view and Ron Paul. What future does the Libertarian Party really have with Rand Paul as the presumptive leader?
Well, I think, you know, those people that show up at his rallies aren't going to be the ones voting. I think there's two types of, well, first of all, there's several types of Tea Party.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the Tea Party that we see that's going to get in lockstep with the election, those are the ones that have that funding behind them, whether it's Koch brother funding and all this other stuff. That might be the corporatization. But some of these other folks that I think, you know, and I hate to use the word more grassroots that are, you know, like, you know, that I just see now here,
sure.
I don't see those cats going to the polls.
I agree.
I don't see them voting at all. I see them wanting to change the dynamic of the system
and having
in many ways a diametrically opposed ultimate vision of how we get to changing, you know, society.
You know, but it is different, Davey D, and that is the fact is, again, McCain, those conservatives cannot get behind John McCain. Just, you know, they really couldn't get behind him. They're getting behind Romney, but right, he won't get all of them because of the Ron Paul people, the Tea Party people that Ron Paul speaks to are disciplined, or you know, they believe, and they'll maybe vote for Gary Johnson, frankly. Well,
he may get enough of them.
The difference of what I would say. Alan West, the folks that I've seen out here today, those ain't Alan West fans, and he's right. A Tea Party cat. So that's the difference. That's how I would divide that. And I don't know exactly what the philosophy is, but he's like, yeah, he uses that word, but that ain't us.
Right.
We're a different brand of folks.
Everyone, we're almost out of time. Mitch Perry, last word.
Let's hope that this convention actually has some excitement, okay? It's really disappointing for Tampa people that the first day did not happen. You know, really, it is a disappointment. So let's just see, you know, some drama happen perhaps some way in the next 3 days.
All right, Mitch Perry. Again, is the news and politics editor of the weekly paper in Tampa, the progressive paper called Creative Loafing. I've been going to your website often to find out what's going on, and listeners can as well by going to cltampa.com. I really enjoyed this with all you all. Mitch, I know you weren't so certain if you could join us throughout the rest of the week, but try to make an effort.
I'll do my best.
All right.
Thank you, Mitch.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the Republican National Convention in Tampa, Florida. We'll be right back.
We're a nation built on freedom, but freedom isn't free. We're a nation built on sacrifice, a land of liberty. And the cross is on 1,000 fields around the world today. Are a testimony to the price brave soldiers had to pay. So I'm thankful for those who stand up for the red, white, and blue, for those who put their lives on the line. And I'm proud to say that I live in the USA. This is the land of the free. This is the home of the brave. Liberty for USA. So as time has come and time has gone in the land of the free, we've had soldiers ride.
Well, that was a song from yesterday's event in Tampa at the Tampa Theater. It was the Ralph Reed event, Faith and Unity. And it also had Ralph Reed. Now, Ralph Reed is a very interesting character. Ralph Reed was very influential during the 1990s with the Christian Coalition. He was also somewhat involved in the controversies of 2005 with Tom DeLay and Jack Abramoff. Oh, he never got indicted, though, to be clear. But he has these get-togethers. Newt Gingrich was at this event, as was Mike Huckabee, and Scott Walker. And in fact, we're going to hear Scott Walker, who is the Wisconsin governor, in just a moment. But first, let's hear a little bit from Ralph Reed.
Thousands of centrifuges spin as we gather here today at nuclear installations in Natanz and Fordro and other nuclear sites all across that country. And today, the most brutal and bloody dictatorship in the bloodiest and most dangerous region of the world stands on the threshold of possessing the most dangerous weapons in the history of mankind. In Egypt, the Arab Spring has given way to a cold and bitter radical Islamic winter, and the Muslim Brotherhood, one of the leading terrorist sponsoring organizations in the world, and an ally of Iran, by the way, has taken control of the presidency and the parliament. When you return here to home and you look at the cultural issues, the President of the United States has used the highest office in the land and the bully pulpit of his office to seek to redefine the most time-honored institution in the history of Western civilization, namely the definition of a man and a woman in holy matrimony. Now, my friends, this is an injustice that we are not going to let stand, and either in the courts or on election day, we're going to end it once and for all.
And again, that was Ralph Reed at an event that he pulled off yesterday at the Tampa Theater. Ralph Reed is chair of the Faith and Freedom Coalition, and other notables who were there include Mike Huckabee, Newt Gingrich, and Wisconsin's Governor Scott Walker. Now, when Scott Walker came to speak, some activists hurled a banner that read, "Scott Walker has a Coke problem." And Coke is spelled K-O-C-H, as in the Koch brothers. Here's a little bit what happened after Walker speaks in the demonstration. I followed the demonstrators outside and talked to them as well.
Walker of Wisconsin. Well, I know. God bless you. It is good to see that we're amongst some friends here.
Get out of here! Get out of here!
And they're now taking them out.
What's your name?
Danielle Delirio.
Where are you from, Danielle?
I'm from Chicago.
From Chicago? Did you come to the Tampa for the RNC?
Yes.
Yeah? So tell me what happened inside.
Inside this, which is the Faith and Freedom Convention, there were a lot of conservatives speaking and sharing the Republican platform. And we were here specifically to protest Governor Walker, considering his tremendous amount of funding from the Koch brothers and how we feel that that is unjust and really not actually representative of democracy in the U.S.
What happened when you unrolled the banner?
We unrolled the banner as quickly as we could and were immediately accosted by the police here and taken out.
What did the banner say?
The banner said, "Walker has a Koch problem." Koch being K-O-C-H.
Why was it important for you to come from Chicago to do this action today?
It's important that a lot of these folks, whether they're actual politicians or people running for political office, have a real idea of the type of people that they do or want to represent.
And again, that was one of the demonstrators who hurled a banner as Scott Walker came to speak yesterday. All the demonstrators were detained outside. Nobody eventually, though, was arrested. Here's what Scott Walker had to say afterwards.
You know, some people, you know, freedom endowed by our Creator. Freedom is endowed by our Creator, defined by our Constitution, protected each and every day by the men and women who wear the uniform of this great country. And those men and women who fought so hard fought so that everyone, whether they agreed or disagreed with us, could have a voice, but they also expected that people would do it respectfully.
Yeah! And again, that was Scott Walker speaking yesterday. Again, two events that were really dedicated, I guess, to the right wing. Joining me to talk more about this and the ideology behind it and the movements that are going and how it affects the Republican Party are two guests. Peter Montgomery is a senior fellow at the People for the American Way, and Adele Stan is the Washington, D.C. bureau chief with Alternet. And they're both writing about the right wing on Alternet. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks so much for having us.
Before the Scott Walker thing, we don't have to pay too much attention to that. We know who Scott Walker is.
Sure.
Before that, though, we played the clip from Ralph Reed, who sponsored and organized this event. Who is Ralph Reed?
Well, Ralph Reed is really a Republican political operative, but is probably best known in his guise as the executive director of the Christian Coalition, which was an organization that was dedicated to getting out the vote of right-wing Christian evangelicals back in the 1990s that grew out of the 1988 presidential campaign of Reverend Pat Robertson.
Mm.
And Ralph Reed, after he left the Christian Coalition, he decided he was going to make some money, and he got in trouble with Jack Abramoff by getting in on some shady deals there. And that sort of cost him his political career. He was at the same time trying to run for the lieutenant governor of Georgia. But he's now making his comeback with the group that he is using to organize these events at the convention, the Faith and Freedom Coalition. And he's turning that into a big get-out-the-vote vehicle for conservative voters.
One of the things that really struck me there was when I first got there, there was an American flag, and that obviously was not surprising. There was also an Israeli flag.
Right.
There wasn't a Mexican flag. There wasn't a UK flag. There was an American and an Israeli flag. And then there was this prayer, and I want to play this prayer.
Sure.
Our God and our Father, you are not the God of defeat. You are the God of victory and destiny. And you planted your foot on this earth, on a piece of real estate, and you declared it to be Israel, yours, and your people. And we as your spiritual descendants of Abraham, lift up the physical descendants of Abraham and their nation. They're not occupying a piece of land, they own it because you gave it to them. And we pray supernatural protection from all of their enemies this day. May their enemies be scattered once again, as they have so many times. And we pray that our nation stand with this nation during this critical period, fully aware that you'll continue to bless he who stands with Israel. And so with one heart, this place, this day, we cry out for the peace of Jerusalem. In Jesus' name we pray. And all God's kids said, amen.
Adele Stan, who was that?
That is Jim Garlow, pastor from California. I'm going to turn to my colleague Peter Montgomery to tell us a little bit more about him.
Jim Garlow really popped onto the scene during the Prop 8 fight in California when he became one of the major organizers to get conservative churches to register voters and turn out to defeat marriage equality in California. And that sort of lifted him up into the top ranks of Village Sweat organizers. And so he got hired by Newt Gingrich to run his new Renewing America leadership group. And so ever since then, Garlow's sort of been in the inner circle of the religious right.
What is happening? Why was there an Israeli flag on the stage?
There's a lot that's been going on with this particular. I mean, what you have, what I saw yesterday, and there was a number of prayers, or invocations, or even just political speeches speaking to the situation in the Middle East and the the evangelical community as a stalwart ally of Israel. And so you have the wedding of the secular neocon foreign policy agenda, plus the othering of Barack Obama, who's constantly being kind of whispered about as, you know, maybe not quite Christian, maybe not quite American, and kind of trying to paint him as an ally of America's enemies and of Israel's enemies. And then you have the theologizing of this neocon agenda vis-a-vis the end times theology of many religious right sects. So, in other words, the survival of Israel is tantamount to bringing Jesus back for the resurrection.
Is this new, this marriage between neocons and Christian fundamentalists?
I don't know that it's new, but I think it's just increasingly intensified.
Right.
There, you know, Pastor John Hagee, who was one of the guys that John McCain was forced to repudiate when he was running, who has this group, Christians United for Israel. And so there's a large group pushing that. But it's part of even a bigger effort to theologize everything. There's now every issue that we have, the religious right is turning into a religious issue. Even things like the minimum wage or the capital gains tax, they're finding excuses in the Bible for their position. So it's part of this much bigger effort to put a religious grounding under their whole agenda.
Well, I think the marriage, you know, maybe you tell me if you're wrong, but if I'm wrong, but it just seems like when you have this marriage between the evangelicals and the Zionists, hardcore Zionists, really what it boils down to, I just call it white supremacy, plain and simple. I mean, you're looking at an increasing population of people that are challenging folks in power. Many of them have been colonized, you know, victims of genocide, oppression of all sorts who have been rising up. And it's happening here in this country, and it's happening over in the Middle East. And you can find these natural alliances, and you can get large groups of people in lockstep, as you said, if you theologized a lot of this. But I see that marriage more as a thing of convenience. You know, we got the blackening and browning of our backyards, and we don't really want that, so let's form this
general
union.
General populace.
Yeah, and so that's what I just see.
Well, I think, you know, I would call it maybe communities of privilege, coalitions of privilege. I think that's an interesting frame to look at this, and a significant one and an important one. I guess I would caution about the use of the word Zionism, because that's a pretty broad term, and there are plenty of liberal peace, two-state solution people who would consider themselves Zionists, which simply means, you know, wanting Israel to maintain its existence. That's why I choose the term neocon, because that refers to a very, very specific, like you said, hardcore, you know, sort of the Israeli exceptionalism, right, kind of foreign policy.
Well, yeah. I'm referring, well, yeah, maybe there's a difference in that, but I'm just looking at the guy that's going, I do not like those folks
here. Right, I hear you.
They are less than me, and we need to do something
totally
about it. And I don't see them any different than folks that are here in this country that are like, this group of black and brown folks that's on land that we stole, or, you know, what have you, we don't want them here either. And I think they found some common ground.
Right.
Yeah, and I really think in terms of the definition of Zionism, I mean, clearly there are differences on that. There's the Jewish anti-Zionist network, for example.
Your mic is off.
Sure.
Yeah, we got to just, yeah. Your mic, there you go.
Now, I have a mic. I'm sharing a mic with you, Adele. We can get cozy here. And just saying that there are varying views on the definition of Zionism. The Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, for example, you know, they're very, you know, very clear on that. And I think they would differ a little with your definition. But, you know, when we look at Bush that's talking about the dark corners. Remember that phrase, the dark corners, and looking at global policy. And then Mitt Romney on his recent visit to Israel talking about the cultural differences,
right,
between the Palestinian, you know, and the Israeli.
Both groups in some way.
In some way. And I think there's a connection with that and the point that Davey D was making, because if you look at the narrative that the election seems to be going in right now, and the way that I think the Romney Ryan team think that they will win, which is to go for a certain sector of the population to encourage them to vote, that this, you know, the dark corners and the cultural differences and, you know, the kind of underpinnings of a hint of racist stuff covered over in religious art.
Well, it's
so
Willie Horton 2012.
Margaret, I think your mic's working now.
There you go.
Yeah, I think it's a cultural identity election. I think that's, what else do they have? And if you look at, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you know, what else do they have? So it's all about othering anybody who doesn't agree with them in some ways. And, oh, surprise, so many of those people happen to be brown. So many of those people happen to be black. You know what I mean? So,
especially if they aren't Christian. I mean, the anti-Muslim campaigns that have been going on in the United States for the last couple of years, from the very top of the Republican Party and certainly from a lot of the major religious right backers, the kind of language that is used to describe Muslims and this notion, I mean, just even the last week, people saying that, you know, President Obama is weirdly concerned with jihadists. I mean, it's not just Muslims. They're trying to say that he's in league with jihadists. And so it's part of the othering you mentioned. I think it's certainly part of the racism you mentioned.
Well, even in Christian, you know, background, you know, there's a split in the black community because you have what we call prosperity teaching.
Right.
And then you have prophetic teaching. And the prophetic is really, you know, coming up and saying we got to change and look for justice and all that. And, you know, to a large degree, if you look at the roots of prosperity, it's coming out of that God equals country mentality.
That's
of the evangelicals.
Yeah.
And so it's a weird thing, but religion is definitely being used as a tool to get everybody in line if you are on a certain type of mindset with your religion.
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the Republican National Convention in Tampa, Florida, with Davey D, Margaret Prescott. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Our guests this hour are Peter Montgomery with People for the American Way and Adele Stan of Alternate. A few things I want to hit and move us towards as well to talk about, because there was a couple of events yesterday. One in this last one at the Ralph Reed event, there was a woman who spoke. She seemed as though she is an icon to the religious right. Her name is Phyllis Schlafly.
Yes, Schlafly.
I was saying it wrong before, but I have it now. I want to play a little bit of what she had to say, and then let's talk more about who she is.
Dear friends, our religious liberty is at stake in this election because Obama is at war with all religion in any public place, any public square, any public school. They want to confine the meaning of the First Amendment to just the prayer you say when you're inside your church and close the door and nobody can hear you. He would not allow the traditional White House celebration of the National Day of Prayer. All of these add up to a war on religion. We cannot have a president who acts like this.
And again, that was Phyllis Schlafly. Peter Montgomery, she talked about Obama's war on religion. Can you tell me more about who she is and maybe translate for us what she's saying?
Well, Phyllis Schlafly has been lying about people for many, many years. And she was lying about Barack Obama right there. But she is the woman who really cut her teeth in politics by fighting the ERA and probably became the first famous anti-feminist woman. And for decades, she has been on a tirade against feminism, but she's into all kinds of conspiracy theories about the UN and, you know, black helicopters and the idea that the government is trying to force a merger between Mexico and Canada, the United States. So she's sort of an all-around right-wing activist. One of the craziest conferences I've been to in all my years of going to these things was a conference that she organized in 2009 called How to Take Back America. And it was one of the first real backlash against the Obama election events. And we had people there talking about communism and Nazism and telling people to go buy guns and ammo.
Wow.
Yeah, she's well, this is Margaret Prescott, host here on the Grand in Tampa, Florida, as part of the team I'm based out of KPFK. But people, it would be interesting to know that I actually debated Phyllis Schlafly some years ago. I mean, this was during the period, you know, the ERA and all of that. And, you know, I was active on women's rights issues for quite some time. But she's well-loved in the right and has for quite some time. Yes, they do adore her. And the issue we were actually debating was on the issue of caregivers and whether the work of mothers and caregivers should be valued. Remember the conversation that broke out when Ann Romney said, I have five children and therefore I work, and Mitt Romney was saying every mom is a working mom, right? Except, of course, when it comes to low-income moms and moms on welfare, then they're just lazy scroungers.
Takers.
Right? Yeah, takers. And, of course, Romney is using that. He's playing that ad on Obama more than any other ad. We'll be talking about that later in the show. But that was really the issue. And I have to say that on that, we were able to go toe-to-toe. Because with all of the anti-feminist rhetoric, they really didn't have back then much of a comeback to say, well, what do you say about women who are low income and who also have the right to raise our own children? And it's interestingly enough that that debate has now come full circle. Mm. So Phyllis Schlafly rears her head again.
Well, how influential is she?
Oh, extraordinarily. She helped shape the whole right-wing conservative movement. Her political career comes out of the 1964 Barry Goldwater campaign, which is where the roots of our current religious right and our right-wing takeover of the Republican Party, all of that comes, you know, you find the roots of all of that in that 1964 campaign.
Well, let me bring that to the 1964 campaign and bring it to Mitt Romney, because his father, George Romney, was on a very opposite side that we'd see Mitt Romney today. Tell me about that.
Well, I don't pretend to know a great deal of this history, but there was apparently quite an exchange of correspondence between Barry Goldwater and George Romney. And George Romney, you know, that was the year Romney was thinking of running for president, and he refused to endorse Goldwater because he saw him as an extremist and thought that it would cause great division within the country, not just the party, but the country. And you wonder how, you know, Romney, who worships his dad, can do so at the same time that he seems to have absolutely no regard for the effect his campaign, win or lose, is going to have on this country.
Well, his dad also released all those taxes, right?
Right, that's right.
I do have a question for you all. And, I mean, we're talking about the far right,
right.
And its rise and how they seem to be in various sectors of power. But how is it that that has happened when you have a large enclave of people who consider themselves progressive, many of them listening tonight, people who feel that they are to the left and therefore harbor a social justice agenda, an equality agenda, all that? What have been the shortcomings of us, so to speak, that this has happened on our collective watch, from the baby boomers on up to the current generations? What steps have we missed?
That's a very big question.
Yeah, it's a huge question, yeah.
And you got 30 seconds. Yeah.
Well, I will say that there's been all kinds of mistakes that people have made, but one of the things that has gone on is that the other side has just had vast amounts of money that they have invested for four decades in building this infrastructure they have of right-wing law schools, of right-wing universities, of think tanks. And now we're in a worse shape because thanks to the Supreme Court, they can just flood money into the elections. And so it's amazing when you look at all that that they've built and all the money they've got that we're still 50-50.
But if I may, I also want to say that I don't want it to let us off the hook, because for all of their money, the other thing they have is a long view, and they are patient, and they are willing to hang in there at loss after loss. And we tend to organize around elections. At least progressives tend to organize election to election and think that when we've won an election, we've won the day. And they don't think that way.
Would it be that many on the left have not really been sincere about breaking bread in a very fundamental way that allows us to do coalition building? Maybe men don't want to give up patriarchy.
We got all
maybe
kinds of class stuff going
on. Maybe there's a left vacuum in religion.
And there's privilege. There's a lot of privilege stuff. And when you're looking for money from funders are, you know, they're rich people. They don't necessarily live in the same places that the activists do.
Go ahead, Margaret.
Just one quick point, too. These people seem to be the opposite of liberation theologists, and so much resources went into defeating the liberation theology movement south of the border. As recently in Haiti with Jean-Bertrand Aristide. But there's hope. They're nuns on the bus right now. I see them. They're going across country, and they're accusing Paul Ryan of being immoral. So, you know, we do see some activity on the part of those who are not Christian fundamentalists, but who are Christian and religious. And I think we have to wrap it up. But,
well, we have 90 seconds. Yeah. One last question for our guests, Peter Montgomery and Adele Stan, and we'll have to get this out pretty quickly. But you saw Michelle Bachmann yesterday at the Tea Party rally. She's putting her support behind Mitt Romney.
Right.
Can we expect the Tea Party to get behind this ticket?
Mm. It depends on what you mean when you say the Tea Party. So people who support Michelle Bachmann, by and large, probably will. But the Tea Party is a much more amorphous designation than that.
I think so, too. I think the corporate backers of the Tea Party, the institutional folks who have really weighed into electing senators and building power, they'll go with Romney because they want to build their power. I think some of the grassroots activists are really uninterested in Mitt Romney.
Peter Montgomery with People for the American Way and Adele Stan with Alternate. They're both writing on Alternate. You have an article about all these events that we're talking about on that website at alternate.com. Is it?
Org.
Oh, forgive me.
Baby,
forgive me. Well, this was fun. I thank you. I thank you both.
Thank you so much.
And again, you are listening to Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the Republican National Convention in Tampa. We are broadcasting from affiliate station WMNF. I'm Mitch Jezerich with Davey D and Margaret Prescott. We're going to go to a short musical break, and we'll be back with Hour 3 right after this.
And you are listening to 94.1 FM KPFA here in Berkeley and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. It is 6:59 p.m. Africa Today. We'll be back on Monday, September 10th. Now stay tuned for the Pacifica national coverage of the Republican National Convention.
Live from the Republican National Convention in Tampa Bay, Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, generally, and I'm here as part of the Pacifica team from KPFA in Berkeley. I'm joined by Hard Knock Radio's Davey D and Letters and Politics, Mitch Jezerich, live from the Republican National Convention. Before we go into this hour, I just want to give our listeners a little update on what is happening. Tropical Storm Isaac hasn't hit hurricane strength yet, but it's apparently bearing down on New Orleans almost 7 years to the day that Hurricane Katrina hit the region. Isaac has winds right now of 70 miles per hour. Its center was about 230 miles southwest of the mouth of the Mississippi River, and it was moving northwest at 10 miles per hour. Forecasters predicted Isaac would intensify into a Category 2 hurricane with winds of about 100 miles per hour by early Wednesday, around the time it's expected to make landfall. Of course, there's a lot of concern, a lot of worry about the amount of water that might be on the ground. The current forecast track has the storm aimed at New Orleans, but hurricane warnings extended across 280 miles from Morgan City, Louisiana, to the Florida-Alabama state line. It could become the first hurricane to hit the Gulf Coast since 2008. A lot of worried folks there in the Gulf region right now. And Davey D is also with me in this hour from Hard Knock Radio and Mitch Jezerich, Letters and Politics. And Davey D, I mean, here, you know, we had some rain and we had some wind. You were out in the weather this morning covering the protests. The RNC, a lot of our listeners right now know, was postponed. And there's some big question marks about what will happen if indeed a hurricane or even a tropical storm with a lot of water hits the Gulf region and what that might mean in terms of the RNC. But it really brings back a lot of heartbreaking memories, not only in relation to New Orleans, but Haiti. Haiti was just hit yet again.
Right. 19 people died. I think one of the things, and we were talking off air about this, is that I think folks who are listening should really pay close attention to the policies on both, you know, we're at the RNC and, you know, and even at the DNC. What's the policies that they're putting in place that if a catastrophe like Katrina happens again, you know, you have somebody like Paul Ryan, it's like no food stamps, no housing, you know, get rid of all the safety nets. Imagine if those policies were in place 5 years ago. And we've seen a lot of natural disasters, man-made and, you know, and nature-driven over the past 2 years, you know, whether it's Joplin, Tuscaloosa, or just in Richmond, California, you know, with the refinery.
Yeah.
And, you know, imagine if, you know, you have a situation where people are saying, we don't want to pay for, you know, your cost if you have to go to the hospital. We don't want to give you compensation if these companies were neglectful. We want to protect them. We don't want to, you know, replace your home or any of these types of things. These are the types of policies, and I'm just being general, but we can go and look at things very specifically. These are going to have long-ranging impacts, and as we see more and more people finding themselves in dire straits, what's going to be the solution? How are we going to help people? I think that's something we should be concerned, and we should never forget that in New Orleans, many of those people that were displaced are still displaced. There's a new population of people that moved to New Orleans. They've taken over some of those old areas, but they're people that been pushed out, never got back, and I don't think they've ever really had a safety net to really protect and uplift and heal them and put them back on their feet the way that we would like to imagine this country would do. And if they can do that then, and this is 7 years later, and then you have more drastic proposals and legislation that people are trying to push, I think we all should be concerned. That's just how I'm seeing it.
Yeah, we're going to be joined by Sakare Touré, who is on the ground in New Orleans, to let us know what is going on right now, but also reflecting a bit on what didn't happen with recovery after New Orleans. But before that, there's a historic connection, interestingly enough, between Haiti and New Orleans, because the Louisiana Purchase happened as a result of the Haitian Revolution, the victory of the Haitian people when those enslaved rose up and defeated Napoleon's army and led, therefore, for the United States to be able to make the Louisiana Purchase. And a number of people went from Haiti into New Orleans. But Haiti has had its share of disasters. I mean, hurricanes, as well as clearly the earthquake that happened. But in 2004, a major hurricane flooded the city of Gonaïves. I think it was Hurricane Jean. And 2004, also the year that the first democratically elected president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was displaced in a U.S.-backed coup. 2008, four hurricanes slammed into Haiti. It was Faye, Gustave, Hannah, and Ike, and now Isaac,
right?
Now on these shores, but went through Haiti. And on the line with us, I'd like to welcome Jocelyn Gay, who is a Haitian activist. She's based in New York City. She also is a host of a Haitian radio program there. Jocelyn, thank you so very much for joining us.
Good evening, or is it good night to you all? It's a pleasure.
Yeah. Yes, it is good evening here. Jocelyn, now, we understand with Isaac that 19 lives were lost. As you know, there was a lot of concern, 400,000 people still living in tent cities following the earthquake there, the mudslides and the flooding. What can you tell us about the situation on the ground as a result of Isaac, Jocelyn Gay?
Well, unfortunately, since before 1986, because we've had our share of hurricanes, as you just were mentioning them, and it's every time, sometimes even without a hurricane, we get mudslides. Like there was the situation in Mapo and Fonverret, the city that is close to the border of the Dominican Republic with Jimani. Quite a few people died because it was raining in the mountains, and then they didn't know what hit them in the middle of the night. The mud came down and then buried a lot of people under the mountains. So we've had our share of disasters, and this latest hurricane, Isaac, it's like a tradition. Okay, where we situated, we get hit all the time by all these disasters. But what compounded is that for a long time, and it's not just because of our latest history that Haiti has been seeing all these things. Deforestation started since when we were colonized by the French, because a lot of our trees were pretty good trees, and they took them to make furniture out of them in France. So it started then, and Duvalier compounded it by cutting a lot of trees to keep rebels, people fighting from his government, to hide in the forest. And then it would got from bad to worse, and people now needing trees to make charcoal. And then there we go.
Let me ask you this. You know, looking at that history, what do you think the United States in its policies, and as we're looking at the election coming up, what do you think we've been as a country negligent in? And is there any policies that you see coming down the pipe being talked about or not talked about that raises grave concern as we look at what is going on in Haiti right now?
Unfortunately, I don't see the U.S. doing anything for us. Hey, we were just talking about New Orleans, right? New Orleans is still in bad shape. If you cannot make your own bed, how in the world can you make somebody else's bed? This is one of our proverbs. You have to make your bed first, and then you make other people's bed. I don't see. I think the policy of the U.S. is practically indifferent. Until we, the Haitian workers, are able to give their labor at a cheap price for manufacturing, for garment manufacturers, or when we used to make baseball for the world, we were the highest producer of baseball. Haiti doesn't even play baseball, okay? Until if our labor is not there, available, cheap enough, we're not important. This is what we are. With all the policies that these big countries have had, they kill. The Haiti is basically an agricultural country. All the agriculture in Haiti has been killed, and most of the food that we consume is imported. Not only imported from the U.S., imported even from the Dominican Republic. So our agriculture has been practically decimated. It's not that there's still not some pockets of Haiti that can feed the country, but this is not the priority, to really sustain the peasants so that they can really grow food, and organic food for that matter, to feed the people. So I don't see the U.S. doing that. The plan that Mr. Clinton has along with Bush, and we know those two guys, they were not that much enamored of people in the U.S. itself. It's not really for the mass of the people in Haiti. It's for a few people to come and enjoy the beaches of Haiti. So they plan to build big hotels, and so tourists will come. Well, I've gone to enough countries to know that the facade of tourism hides squalor behind it. It's the same thing in Jamaica and all the other islands that I've gone to.
Yeah.
Yes, the facade is tourism, and then behind is abject misery.
Yes, and Jocelyn Gay, on that point of abject misery, we also know cholera. There's been a cholera epidemic. 7,000 have died. UN troops brought cholera to Haiti. And, of course, now with the rains and the hurricane, there's a lot of worry about that becoming worse. But we just have about a minute or so. But Haiti is always seen as a nation of victims. It didn't start, you know. And I wanted your comment on that, because even with all of the tragedy in Haiti, that's not necessarily the case from what I hear. What's your take on it?
It's not. Actually, every time enemies coming with a plan to really keep us in abject poverty, there's always fighting. When they least expect it, we rise and we fight. So we don't act like victims. Everybody recognizes that the Haitian people is one of the most industrious people in the world. Even if they only have 5 cents, they get some peanuts into a container and then they try to sell it because they want to be self-sufficient and get themselves out of poverty and misery. And the country itself has a lot of wealth besides the people's labor and the goodwill of the people. There are a lot of other things that the land itself. This is the same land that made France a multi-billion-dollar colony. That land hasn't disappeared. Oh, and everybody wants a piece of it, and you know that predators never go where there's no food. They go into Haiti because there's something for them to take. And Haitians are always fighting against being victimized. They always stand up. They always rise. So we don't want anybody to feel sorry for us. We want support from people who, like Mr. Robinson, for example, who had a hunger strike to really support us. People like this who know that we're not lazy. We want to stand up on our own feet. But when you have a little piece of a little knife in your hand and somebody has a machine gun, the balance of power is a little difficult. And we're still occupied by this armed force. That's because they know that we're not going to take a lot of crap without fighting. Otherwise, we would have been controlled by remote control.
Yes, and on that note, Jocelyn Gay, we are going to have to wrap it up. We are here in Tampa Bay, Florida. Of course, there's a huge Haitian community in Florida, and I am sure, you know, wanting to make their voices heard. So, Jocelyn Gay, thank you so very much for joining us.
That was my pleasure.
All righty. And I said earlier, Davey, there is that connection between Haiti and New Orleans. Right now, even as we sit, this tropical storm may be a hurricane bearing down, headed towards New Orleans. We have Sakare Touré, who is on the line with us, and he is in New Orleans, and he is with United Saints Recovery Project of New Orleans. And Sakare has said that he will not be evacuating. We'll be staying on the ground. Sakare, thank you so very much for joining us. Sakare, are you there? All righty. We will try to get Sakare Touré back on the line. But Davey D, you know, I can't imagine what people are going through right now in New Orleans. I mean, it seems as though we're reliving. It is 7 years practically to the day of Hurricane Katrina.
And I mean, you know, that aftermath, you know, after those levees broke, it's still very surreal. I mean, we're talking about not just the city being flooded, but let's talk about all the vigilante killings that took place. Let's talk about the cops shooting people on the Danziger Bridge and on the other bridge. I'm going to remember its name in a second. But you had all that type of madness that was going on. And what it underscored was this country looking at a group of people and saying, you're undesirable. You're less than human. If you recall, when people went to Houston, Barbara Bush, you know, the President Bush's mom, said that these folks were better off
in the shelter
than they were having a home in New Orleans. And so I don't know if things have fundamentally changed, you know, because we've had the Gulf situation with the BP. And the only difference is that some of that gets swept under the rug. It's like we hear about it. They say we're going to make it right. And then everything disappears and you don't see those names. You don't see those faces. You don't hear from, in particular, those black and brown folks who, you know, oftentimes are at the short end of the stick. What is going on? And I think that when we look at these conventions, we should be paying close attention to the policies. I said this earlier, that both parties have in store for folks who go through these hard times. And it seems like there's been this adversarial position taken by some that if you go through hard times, it's your fault. If you got flooded out in New Orleans, Margaret, that's your fault.
Yeah.
You know, we blame you. Pull yourself up seems to be the mantra.
Well, the mantra certainly here in Tampa Bay for this RNC. And I hope we do now have Sakare Touré on the line with us. Sakare, are you there?
I am here. Good evening to everybody.
Okay, good evening. Sacrobith United Saints Recovery Project in New Orleans. Tell us, what is the situation on the ground right now? How are people reacting? Are some people evacuating, people staying? What's the scene on the ground?
Well, there are people who are evacuating, and starting on yesterday, the gas lines have been very long, so people have been hitting the road. Others are going to be here. Our organization, in addition to being a post-Katrina entity that aids folks who are on the lower rung of the economic strata, we are also a first respondent, so we're going to be here. I would estimate at this stage, unless that is a mandatory announcement for evacuation, majority of New Orleanians will stay put.
Now, Sakura, we are here in Tampa Bay. The RNC convention, you know, delayed because of a storm, tropical storm Isaac, may become a hurricane by the time it hits over in your area. And there's a lot of talk and reflection in the RNC platform about austerity measures, about, you know, cutbacks in healthcare, cutbacks in just about everything. And when we look at post-Katrina and what has not happened, and also a lot of people complaining about big government, except when you do need government services to come in when there is a natural disaster. Sakura, tell us, what do you think about the post-Katrina recovery? Are you feeling that much progress has been made now, or are things still in a pretty bad situation there, particularly for people at the bottom?
It's ironic that Isaac, if it turns into a hurricane, it's predicted it's going to hit land on Wednesday. Wednesday is the 29th of August, the 7th-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And basically for the New Orleans majority community, in essence, the African-American community, as well as poor whites, but overwhelmingly the African-American community, they have not recovered from Katrina. So if Isaac does turn into a hurricane, it's essentially going to add insult to injury. Pre-Katrina, we had a African-American population of New Orleans of approximately 80%. Right now, as I speak to you 7 years later, we got approximately 57-58% of that African-American population in the city. 7 years post-Katrina, we have missing from the city between 120 and 130,000 people, most of them African Americans. Keep in mind that folks were evacuated from the eventually after languishing in the Superdome and the convention center for days without provisions, without necessities, were forcibly evacuated out of this city, spread out in 44 states across America, despite the fact that the majority of the state of Louisiana was dry. Overwhelmingly, it was African-American that was forced out here. Members of the white community, instead of put on trains and plane and gotten out of the state, they were put on buses and taken to western and northern Louisiana. Part of that evacuate community is that those numbers, that aforementioned numbers, of them still being evacuees 7 years later, and most of them do want to come home. We have communities such as the Lower Ninth Ward that's missing four-fifths of its original population, four-fifths. We have other.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm sorry, if you finish your point, I didn't want to cut you off, but I do have a question.
Sure, sure. New Orleans East, another predominantly African-American community, is missing half of its population. Gentilly is missing a third of its population. Like the Lower Ninth Ward, the Desire, Florida community was working poor. Pre-Katrina was a working poor community. It's missing two-thirds of its original population. That has been a concerted effort on the part of the ruling establishment of the city of New Orleans and of the state of Louisiana. And I do not miss my word about this. I've observed this from day one, to really ethnically cleanse this city. But despite...
Well, I'm glad you're mentioning that. And yes, my question was, connecting this to the RNC, especially with Bobby Jindal, governor, and his ascension to power in the RNC, how people see him as a superstar, the policies that are coming out of this body of people, and you can also comment on the policies in the DNC as well, but right now with the policies here, is there any cause for alarm? Are they proposing things? Are the things that they need to say? Are there anything that they're talking about that raises grave concerns to you as a New Orleans?
Oh, absolutely. You know, they're talking about austerity measures when we've already been, you know, in that predicament for 7 years. You mentioned budget agenda. The state of Louisiana is noted as the following. Every time they do the survey, it is usually 48 or 49th in terms of provision of affordable and available health care out of 50 states. Education, it usually falls around about 48 or 49th in terms of making quality education available to its population. We have an inside joke here. It's a rather sick joke, and it goes something like this. Thank God for Mississippi and Alabama, because they're always last. They're the only one that's worse than the state of Louisiana. And yet, Bobby Jindal is the model on how things ought to be nationally. I think there should be some real concern on the part of the national population. All they got to do, the record is obvious here for the state. If they want to implement that nationally, you know, we're going to be like India, where they're walking over, you know, homeless people. And that's been an issue here in New Orleans because of the fact that folks, the poor people's housing have been taken away from them. They demolished public housing for the most part. They gutted it. The homeless population has quadrupled since Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah, so I mean, from what you're describing, Sakura, I mean, it seems as though if we really look at the reality on the ground in New Orleans and we contrast that with what Bobby Jindal, you know, claims to represent, and Davey D is absolutely right. He is a rising star. He has canceled his trip here to the Republican National Convention. But also in the area of education, New Orleans is always put forward as a kind of a model of looking at education down the road. But if you look at what has happened in New Orleans, it basically has been privatized. I mean, public education,
absolutely,
for the most part, has been privatized.
What
impact has that had?
They have used the pretext of the disaster, Katrina, actually a man-made disaster, because really Katrina didn't cause this problem. It was the Army Corps of Engineers and the fact that they bailed the levees in the mid-60s, 1960s, to fail. They used inferior materials and faulty design. And finally, they fessed up to it. Army Corps had fessed up to it about 2.5 years ago. But the pretext of Katrina, the cover of Katrina has been used to get rid of public housing, to essentially redirect taxpayers' money from public schools to essentially de facto private school. But they call it charter, and they say, oh, but it's public. But they get to cherry-pick their students. They get to cherry-pick the teacher. The Katrina was used as a cover to fire 10,000 teachers, the vast majority of them, members of the most powerful union in the state, which was the teachers' union. And that basically was the bottom line. Get rid of union, which, you know, had decent pay. That was a way for, in particular, the African-American in the state of Louisiana to enter into the middle class, have health care benefits for themselves and their family and so forth. And a few weeks after Katrina, the governor fired 10,000 teachers at no cost, absolutely no cost.
So again,
these charter schools get to cherry pick their teachers, and it's very difficult for a former school teacher, even though they have the experience with the students of New Orleans, to get a job in these charter schools. Charter schools constitute fully in the city of New Orleans 75% of the students. They have 75% of the former public school students are in charter school. That is the largest in the nation. Second only to New Orleans is Washington, D.C., and they have 39% charter school.
Right. Sakare, of course, so much happening on the ground, or so much that hasn't happened on the ground in New Orleans since Hurricane Katrina, the 7th year anniversary coming up. And yet again, we have a situation of Isaac, a tropical storm now predicted to become a hurricane to hit New Orleans. And I'm wondering, I gave an update at the top of the hour in terms of what is being said about Isaac. And what I'm wondering is, what is it? We just have a few minutes left, and clearly it's had an impact here, because there's still some discussion about perhaps having to postpone even more of the RNC. There's concern that if Isaac does hit New Orleans and there's a huge party going on at the Republican convention in Tampa, it wouldn't look very good. But what are you hearing on the ground? What are they saying to people in terms of the track of Isaac right now? If we can just get a bit of
up. Well, it was originally designated for Tampa, Florida, and then it moved westward. It changed its course westward, and then it was designated for Alabama, and then it even changed its course again westward, and now it's currently supposedly en route to New Orleans. It's not a foregone conclusion. It's going to hit New Orleans. It may be. Change its route. We hope it just stays out in the Gulf and don't hit any land and wear itself out. That's the best case scenario.
Right, but you haven't seen any change in weather there yet. You don't have any indications.
And the weather has been unusually mild, and we're still in summer, which July and August is our worst month here in the state of Louisiana in terms of humidity and heat index. But it was an unusually mild day. We hopefully it's not the calm before the storm. As the euphemism goes. So, yes, that is a concern, definitely a concern, especially as I indicated before, we still got people struggling to recover. We got about 38% of New Orleans community that have not been restored still. And this would just exacerbate the problem. And in regards to the issue,
Sakurai, we just have about a minute left, really. And they are telling people it's a voluntary evacuation. We know with Katrina, a lot of people just didn't have the resources to get out. Quickly, can you tell us, for about 30 seconds, are there any resources being put in place to help people evacuate?
Probably is one of the best kept secrets. There are resources. I know there are resources. Well, whether they make those resources available to the people who need it the most, that's a whole different story. And that usually that's
right. So you're not hearing much about that.
And this is the worst time too. People have not gotten that paycheck. They're on assistance, any kind of assistance. They haven't gotten their assistance, and just to put them out there and ask them to leave town to pay hotel bills and gas and so forth. It's totally unreasonable if those resources are not upfront made available to them.
Right. And from what you're saying, they must not be. Well, we are going to have to leave it there. Sakura Touré, based in New Orleans, thank you so very much for joining us.
Yes, and thank you for the invitation, and good evening to yourself and to your listeners.
Right. This is Margaret Prescott. This is the Pacifica National coverage live from the Republican National Convention in Tampa Bay, and from KPFA in Berkeley. I'm joined by Hard Knock Radio's Davey D and Letters and Politics' Mitch Jeserich. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
live from the Republican National Convention in Tampa Bay. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth from KPFK in Los Angeles and from KPFA in Berkeley. I'm joined by Hard Knock Radio's Davey D and Letters and Politics, Mitch Jeserich. And we are now going to welcome our listeners to the roundtable part of Pacifica's convention coverage for some analysis of election politics as we are now in the convention's stage of the election. And I would like to welcome our panelists. We have three panelists for this part of the coverage. I'd like to welcome Jackie Goldberg, who is a former member of the California State Assembly. She previously served as a member of Los Angeles City Council, and before being elected to the council, she served on and was later president of the Los Angeles School Board. Jackie Goldberg hails from the free speech movement of the 1960s and the anti-war movement at UC Berkeley before going on to go become the head of the Los Angeles Unified School Board. Jackie Goldberg, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Not in the rain. On the line with us on the road, I'd like to welcome Tom Hayden. Tom Hayden was made famous as part one of the people. I don't think you were involved in it, Tom Hayden, but the police riot that followed the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. Tom Hayden drafted the Port Huron Statement for Students for a Democratic Society. He went on to become an elected official serving in the California State Assembly and Senate. He writes regularly for The Nation magazine, and his work has appeared in a number of other publications, including the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and he teaches also at a number of colleges and universities in the area. Tom Hayden, thank you for joining us.
Hello from Port Huron.
You are in Port Huron. Okay, very good.
Why not?
Alrighty. Yes, the 50th anniversary. And also on the line with us, we'd like to welcome Dr. Gerald Horn. He holds the Moores Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. His research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. Dr. Horn is now working on his 34th book, including Negro Comrades of the Crown, his latest, African Americans and the British Empire Fight the U.S. Before Emancipation and Fighting in Paradise, Labor Union, Racism, and Communists in the Making of Modern Hawaii. Dr. Gerald Horn, thanks for staying up and being with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So we are here on the ground in Tampa Bay. The RNC, I saw one headline that said, well, it's starting out with a bit of a whimper. It has been postponed. I'd like to talk a little bit about strategy with you all. The Ryan Romney camp seemed to have a race and class strategy in place that they think can take them to the White House. And starting off looking at austerity, looking at the economic issues and austerity as a strategy, I really wanted to start out with you, Tom Hayden. And what does the Ryan pick say about what the Romney camp thinks they need to win? Tom Hayden.
Well, I think Ryan is the Tea Party incarnate who gives a lot of motivation to the Tea Party members. One might even say that the ticket is the stalking horse for the Tea Party. But more than that, I'm just guessing, since I'm from the same areas of Wisconsin that he is, Ryan brings a Wisconsin strategy, that is the ability to keep Scott Walker not only elected but in office in the face of a huge, extraordinary social movement that went on for longer than a year. The key to that is right-wing populism or conservative populism, and it consists of it requires a deep recession in which white working class voters and middle class people don't feel they have either the desire or the capacity to have their taxes transferred to black people in Milwaukee. That would be the Wisconsin model. And so this anxiety about taxes can't be separated from you know, who benefits from the taxes. And I think that's the heart and soul of the strategy. It's not a new strategy, but it could possibly work in a recession, which is all about the next couple of months.
Let me add a little wrinkle to this. This is David D., and I want to direct this to Gerald Horn. We just got across here in the wires about John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, just today here in Tampa. He stated that he hopes blacks and Latinos won't show up to the election, and he's counting on widespread apathy from black and Latinos to not show up for the election. He says that will be a very decisive and to their advantage. Can you, you know, based upon what we're talking about, can you contextualize those remarks in something that is also historic in terms of dampening down our expectations and our desires to go to the polls?
Well, first of all, there's no secret that voter suppression is going to be a number one weapon for the GOP going forward for this November election. We already know that Eric Holder's Justice Department is bringing litigation in that regard. We already know that the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and the American Civil Liberties Union as well are bringing lawsuits with regard to voter suppression. That is nothing new, but I think what's really remarkable about the GOP strategy thus far, and this is brought forward by Thomas Edsel in his column in the New York Times just this morning, is just the rank racism that's being deployed. That is to say, these ads that are basically misstating Mr. Obama's position with regard to welfare reform, the so-called joke that Mr. Romney made in Michigan about birtherism, this film that conservative advocate Dinesh D'Souza has released that did quite well at the box office, entitled 2016, which is a total distortion of Mr. Obama's record, basically trying to portray him as some sort of Mau Mau anti-colonialist. But perhaps what's most disturbing about this election going forward is that the Democrats are in a position where they're not able to reward their most loyal constituency, which is African Americans, because of the racism, which suggests that if Mr. Obama were to do so, he would be engaged in special pleading. This is a perverted kind of politics, and it seems to me that down that route lies disaster.
Yeah, and Jackie Goldberg, bringing you into this discussion, I mentioned at the top of the hour that the Romney-Ryan camp seemed to have a race and class strategy. We've touched on both of those briefly. We'll go return to those. But just in terms of sex, if you look at sex, race, and class and the women's vote, you're seeing huge margins in the votes, even among white women voters in terms of Obama and Romney-Ryan. And, of course, there is the Aiken effect in relation to the comments on rape. And, Jackie Goldberg, I wondered if you wanted to comment on this. And do you think that this will really matter at the end of the day? Could there be an edge and some votes lost as a result of all of this?
Well, I think that the bet is that the white men will make the white women vote for Romney. I think they're going to lose that bet.
Okay.
I really mean that. I have not seen young women. You know, I work with 20s and early 30s who are going into teaching. And they are universally, I'm embarrassed to admit, quite uninterested in national politics, electoral politics, until this started to happen. And now they begin to think, you mean we might lose contraception? We might lose abortion? We thought those fights were over. I think that they have maybe, it's too soon to tell it yet, although the polling seems to indicate what I'm seeing anecdotally. I think they've misjudged how badly women know they need to control our own reproductive systems. And I think they've misjudged that really badly. And I think that they realized that the moment that the Aiken thing started, because they thought they were going to get to be able to do this whole election from now until November now, end of summer to November, Labor Day to November, without talking about social issues that might move both women who are Republican and certainly will move a lot of both women and men who are independents away from their ticket. Maybe not to vote for Obama. maybe not to vote at all. I think that the whole question of reproductive rights of women and the war on women, which is becoming clearer and clearer to women who are not normally engaged in politics, may turn out to be one of the biggest factors in this election.
Well, Jackie Goldberg, I have a follow-up on that because I'm looking at a headline from Bloomberg. A Republican candidate likens rape pregnancy to out of wedlock one, and that's bound to add fuel to the fire. And just to remind our listeners that this is Pacifica Radio live from the Republican National Convention, and this is the roundtable part of our coverage, and our panelists are Jackie Goldberg, Tom Hayden, Dr. Gerald Horn. So, you know, they're not letting up, Jackie Goldberg, on this.
No. I think when you begin talking about types of rape, rape mm-hmm. as a form of, I heard one of the Republicans just today say that, no, actually it was Ryan. It doesn't matter to him the form of the conception. Rape is a form of conception? Really? That's not what we used to call it. We used to call it assault against women, you know. So suddenly now it's a form of conception. He said it doesn't matter what the form of conception is when he was being asked about this. I think the more that they try to talk about distinctions amongst rapes and the more they try to talk about incest and rape not being covered by abortion, and that Romney keeps trying to backpedal away from Paul Ryan, but he picked Paul Ryan. You know, it's sort of like I want to have it both ways. I want to say that I'm this, but I'm really that. And I don't think women are buying this, and I think women are finally tuning in that this is not a joke and we're not laughing. This is actually serious, and these guys, if in office, would actually do this to us. And as soon as women believe that that's what happened, because, you know, right now, 95% of Catholic women use birth control. Okay, that's from the bishop's own study. 95% of American women who are Catholic, who are practicing Catholics, use birth control. So if 95% of the women who are Catholic use birth control, you know that the issue of someone threatening access to abortions on demand, you know that there are an awful lot of women who are finally thinking, I think they really are after us. This really is a war on us.
Let me ask you this, Jackie, or anybody else that's there on the panel, Tom or Gerald. You mentioned something, I think you said something about people may not vote. What does the Democrats need to do
to bring
that woman vote over there? I mean, what specifically? And, you know, where I really want to focus on are people who bear the brunt of a lot of these policies, women of color, black and brown women, in particular, who are often demonized, not just with this war, but also on the economic tip, the welfare queen, the mothers that are giving birth to quote-unquote anchor babies, the whole nine. What does the Democrats need to do to really energize that base of people?
Yeah, and it'll be good to, Jackie, to hear from you on that. Also, Tom Hayden, what do you think?
Jackie?
Well, I think what they need to do is they just need to be continuously reminding people of first what the platform of the Republican Party is, and secondly to simply use their own words against them. Because the thing about the Republicans is that just as they think they might be about to snatch victory, they find a way to snatch defeat out of victory by finally telling people what they really believe. You see, they don't talk about it as much as humanly possible except to each other in quiet places. But now they're talking about it more boldly because the Tea Party believes it's kind of won the Republican Party, and now it no longer needs to be in the shadows. And I think that is what Democrats have to do in every race, whether it's a House race or a Senate seat, whether it's in local elections. Every election that's going to happen on the same day in November, where at whatever level, Democrats need to remind women that the battles that were fought in the past can be undone if there is a different administration in power and if there is a different control of the Senate and the House, then, well, the House is already Republican, if we can't stop them from gaining control of the Senate. And that's got to be a part of every campaign. It doesn't matter whether you're a male candidate or a female candidate. Everybody needs to be talking about this, because women for a long time have been lulled into a false sense of security that all of these issues were settled 40 years ago. I'm not even 40 years old. I don't even remember when these battles occurred. It's history. I mean, don't bother me. Well, now people are finally, women in particular, but some men as well, are beginning to realize that this is not a joke. This is what this group of right-wing Republicans and right-wing conservatives have always wanted to happen. Huckabee has not backed away from Aiken. A whole host of other people in the Southeast have not backed away from Aiken, because that is their position, and it is Paul Ryan's position, and he needs to be saddled with it by the Democrats.
Yes, and Tom Hayden, bringing you into this discussion, because looking at the polls, you know, they're saying that pretty much the race is neck and neck right now. And even on the issue of Medicare, there doesn't seem to be a whole heck of a lot of difference between Obama and Romney Ryan team at this point. So what do you think is happening, and what do you think, getting back to Davey D's question, that the Democrats have to do? Tom Hayden.
Well, I don't know what you mean about there's no difference between Obama and Romney on Medicare.
And some of the polls are showing, in Florida, for example, some of the polls are showing that there's very little difference. I mean, Obama is ahead, but not by as much as one would think.
I think there's some voter confusion that Obama has to clear up about what Romney means to do with Medicare. I think it's very clear that they'd like to get rid of Obamacare, which means devastating impacts for people of color and poor people through the Medicaid cuts. But what can they do? Is more like, what can the Pacifica office, the Pacifica audience do? I think besides all that has been said by Gerald and Jackie, particularly the point about people being shocked that settled issues are coming back, I ran into that from women in Austin the other night, and we had a long discussion about how nothing is ever gone, really. That goes in cycles. I think that this idea that the election will be stolen is something that should unite progressives, no matter what their taste for electoral politics is. Stolen by the deliberate attempts to suppress, depress, or divert voter participation in Ohio and Florida, not only through these laws, but simply through not having enough ballot boxes, making it harder to vote early, which means people will be lining up in droves in cold weather, and students will be find it much harder to vote in places like Wisconsin. That combined with Citizens United and the Koch brothers and the infusion of money, millions, maybe $1 billion, from secret donors, by the way, who never have to be identified during the election. That is theft on a grand scale, and it should concern people. I think deeply enough to get some squads out there, to get people out trying to fight back against the theft, and make sure that every polling place is blanketed with observers and lawyers and potential complainants, because if it's as close as it might be, and then I think a lot of us believe for sure it's stolen. And so the difference between stolen elections, the difference that's made, just think back to Gore.
Yeah.
Florida, you're down in Florida. There wasn't enough of a fight by the Gore forces and the civil rights movement against that that Florida vote, and as a result, we'll never know what Gore would have done as our first environmental president. There wouldn't have been a George Bush, number two. There wouldn't have been necessarily an Iraq war. We lost a decade. We lost a lot of lives, and so
right.
that's what people can do on the ground.
Let me ask a question to Gerald. There was a recent report that came out from the Malcolm X grassroots movement that shows the amount of police killings that are going on, people being killed by law enforcement. And with the data that they gathered, it's showing that one every 36 hours an African-American is being killed. As somebody who travels the country a lot, and even just here, in Florida, where Trayvon Martin is still weighing on people and police brutality is still a topic du jour, but is not necessarily reflected in the mainstream press. How do we start? What do we need to do to really reconcile that reality with the election? Or do you think that will make a difference? It does seem to weigh on a lot of the people that I speak to. I'm not sure how you might see it in terms of it impacting the 2012 election.
Well, I think it's a very significant issue, obviously. Not only the issue that you mentioned so cogently, but the stop and frisk.
Right, all that's involved. Yes, stop and frisk.
The nation. But I think that your previous guest, I'm afraid, put his finger on what is really a major issue with regard to this election. Your previous guest noted correctly that with regard to most socioeconomic indices, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama are 48th, 49th, and 50th. And yet, those states are the base of the Republican Party. And yet, in those states, you have the white vote, in particular the white male vote in Mississippi, voting 94% in favor of the Republican Party. This is an amazing, astonishing cross-class alliance. And until the progressive movement begins to see that as a major problem and begins to direct some ideological affirmative action to turn those kinds of numbers, well, then we won't be able to discuss these issues of racist persecution that you so correctly point to as being major, because the political scale is tipped to the right when you have poor white working class and middle class people voting against their interests, and yet it seems the progressive movement is unable to do anything to reverse that tragedy.
Yes, and Dr. Horn, Davey D. rightly pointed out and noted the article that just came out, actually a quote from Boehner saying that, well, the hope is that, you know, people of color just won't come out to the polls. Because, Dr. Horn, there's also the problem that the RNC has in relation to immigration. I mean, Marco Rubio could, you know, give a keynote speech as much as he would like. But clearly the message coming from the Latino community is that this is just not on the platform of the RNC right now on Republican, on immigration issues. And I wondered also, Dr. Horn, if you wanted to just comment briefly on that. We just have a few minutes left before we have to wrap up our roundtable. Dr. Horn.
Well, it's apparent that the Latinos are going to be voting against the Republican 7-3. It's apparent that the population of Asian origin is going to be voting against the Republicans, either 7-3 or 6-4. So I don't think we should take seriously any effort by the GOP to appeal to these voters. I think that any attempt to seem as if they're appealing to these voters is basically a head fake. They basically want to assure white middle class and suburban voters that they are not enmeshed in a party of white supremacy when they vote for the GOP, because supposedly the GOP is making this outreach. I think that going forward in November, the key for the GOP in terms of winning this election, quite frankly, is voter suppression. The math and the numbers are against them otherwise.
Yes, and just, Davey, maybe we could just have a brief final comment, if you could just take maybe about 30 seconds or so, each of you, in terms of any key issue you want to highlight as we're going into this week of the convention here in Tampa Bay. And why don't we start with you, Tom Hayden?
I think that the progressives and the left ought to view the election partly in terms of the chance to debate in civic society different perspectives on the economy. I mean, I don't think we can rely on Paul Krugman to be our standard bearer against Paul Ryan. It goes deeper than that. Secondly, I think people who don't ordinarily pay that much attention to electoral politics ought to realize that there's a lot at stake here for people of color, for the Dream Act students, for the LGBT community, for people who have managed to move forward a little bit in the last few years. And third, everybody has said it, voter suppression is a real menace. I mean, the Democrats generally try to win elections with money and propaganda. The Republicans are reduced to trying to win elections by stealing them. It's come to that. I don't think middle America is ready to believe that, but I think it's true, and we need to understand that in our bones.
Right. Well, I'm afraid on that note, we are going to have to leave it there. Jackie Goldberg, Tom Hayden, Dr. Gerald Horn, thank you so very much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
All righty. And coming up, we'd like to remind everybody we're going to be opening the phones at 800-958-9008. That's 800-958-9008. We'll be right back.
And good evening. You are listening to 94.1 FM KPFA here in Berkeley and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. It is 7:58 p.m. Transitions on Traditions will be back, I think, September 10th, Monday, September 10th, but next week? Oh, apparently he will be back next week. So for now, stay tuned to our last hour of the Pacifica National coverage of the Republican National Convention.
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the Republican National Convention in Tampa, Florida. Along with Davey D and Margaret Prescott, I'm Mitch Jezerich, and we're coming to you from Pacifica affiliate WMNF in Tampa. Very thankful to the good folks at WMNF to help us out. We would have been coming to you from the Republican National Convention, but as you now know, the convention has been delayed a day because of Tropical Storm Isaac. Well, this is the hour that we're going to be taking listener phone calls from across the nation. We want to know what you think about the Republican National Convention, next week the Democratic National Convention, politics in general in this presidential year. We're going to have a great conversation. I'm going to give you that phone number right now. It's 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008. We will also take your emails at conventions@pacifica.org. So hit us up on email at conventions, plural,
conventions at pacifica.org. Again, the number 1-800-958-9008. Again, for the rest of this hour, David E., Margaret Prescott, and myself will be taking your calls, and we'll be talking the talk of all that there is to talk about. And as we get you lined up on the phones and in the email, we're actually going to go to this commentary from KPFA's Ian Master. Ian Masters is KPFK Ian Masters. Sorry, it's a little bit late here. Long show, but Ian Masters is the host of the popular afternoon show on KPFK Background Briefing.
Welcome to Pacifica Radio's coverage of the Republican Convention from Tampa, Florida. I'm Ian Masters, host of Background Briefing, with today's commentary on the gathering that is, for all intents and purposes, the Tea Party Convention, given the almost complete capture of the party by its right wing, which was repackaged by Karl Rove and Dick Armey as an astroturf faux populist movement posing as grassroots patriots dedicated to implementing the policies of their billionaire backers. And this is definitely not your daddy's Republican Party. And it's completely unrecognizable from your granddaddy's GOP that used to be dominated by, dare I say, liberal Republicans from the Northeast, an area now almost completely blue, having swapped colors with the once Dixiecrat South, which is now almost completely red with the Republicans having become a Southern party. Of course, this time around in Tampa, they're fronted by two Northerners, with a Mormon at the top of the ticket, which, of course, the base, the fundamentalist Christians, are still not too thrilled about. But if you really look at this television coverage and you look in the background behind the strategically planted token minorities of women, you see this conclave of white, mostly Southern and Midwestern males, and they're all fired up and they're angry and they're motivated. Of course, they're misinformed, but they're celebrating their determination to take back America from a Muslim socialist terrorist-loving imposter with a fake birth certificate who, if he's ever reelected, will take away their guns and send in UN troops to round up every God-fearing, righteous Christian patriot and turn them into gay-loving, American-hating, food stamp-using, welfare-sponging slaves of a communist world government. Little wonder they are fired up and ready to win. Conversely, of course, the Democrats are all disillusioned and upset that their miracle worker of hope and change did not deliver on the full menu of promises. They may well not show up, and the Republicans who we are witnessing now may well win by default. But if they don't win by default, clearly the Republicans have made a wise investment in ignorance. With the majority of their voters holding bizarre anti-intellectual belief systems that are hostile to science and impervious to facts. Having set up a system where millions of Democrats who are eligible voters, who have voted before, they make them jump through hoops to prove who they are in order to vote in 2012, while a handful of billionaires who are buying the election for the Republicans don't have to reveal who they are. What a deal. Given the recent report from the Federal Reserve and from the Pew Research Center about the shrinking middle class, it does look like monumental hubris and an in-your-face insult that a bona fide member of the 1% and his sidekick, a callous numbers-crunching disciple of Ayn Rand, can turn what's left of America's economy into a fully-fledged plutonomy and have what's left of our democracy completely captured by an oligarchy. And, as an additional last-minute push to get the GOP over the top, to make up for the gaffe-prone Romney-Ryan team's occasionally unscripted cluelessness, there's always the possibility of a little shock and awe war cooked up by Mitt's friend Bibi to bomb America's least favorite country, Iran. So, meanwhile, we wait for the hurricane to see whether Tampa, parts of which are below sea level, will be met by a biblical flood. And, of course, if you want to get something to eat in Tampa, forget about the best restaurant in town. It's already been taken over by a big money Republican lobbyist. And this has been Ian Masters, host of Background Briefing on the Pacifica Radio Network, with a commentary on the Republican National Convention in Tampa, Florida.
And this is Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the Republican National Convention. I'm your host, Mitch Jezerich, along with Margaret Prescott and Davey D. And again, this hour, we are going to be taking your phone calls and your emails. The number is 1-800-958-9008. It's possible right now our lines are full, but write down that number. You'll get it again. We want you to participate throughout the rest of the hour. You can also hit us up on email at conventions@pacifica.org. Let's go to our first caller. We're going to go to Madison, Wisconsin. Abu, you are on the air. Good evening to you, sir.
Thank you very much. And this is a very professional coverage. I wasn't expecting to pay a little any attention to these conventions. But when I tuned in for Flashpoints, I got this and I stayed with it. And my goodness, what a professional coverage this is and behind-the-scenes look. But and just as another sidebar, you know, the commentary you had by Ian Meisters, this is a person who promotes America's foreign policy, meaning, you know, all those against those mullahs and people of brown color and Muslims. And he curiously says this about Iran being the favorite enemy. This person's always railing against
Abu, mullahs. I don't want to get into I kind of want to keep this the convention,
Sure.
So let's go there. I mean, there could be a lot of things said about us all.
Please.
Especially me.
I am not excited one bit about this convention. We've got people who are not attendant to the people's problems. This includes President Obama, and it includes Romney. It's the same difference. I'm not going to vote, and not that I can't vote, but I'm not going to vote. This is not for me, and I'm not interested in saving the American system. Thank you.
All right, Abu, thank you so much again. Margaret, you want to jump in on this? You're looking at me.
Well, I think I would be interested to hear from some other callers. Again, not...
Your mic is on.
You know what? That's,
ADD, why don't you go?
There, Margaret, I turned your mic on.
Is my mic on now?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear from some other listeners. I mean, I know there are a number of people out there who are saying don't vote. There are some people out there who are saying go vote, but vote for a third-party candidate. You know, there's Peace and Freedom. There's the Green Party. And then there are others, you know, who are saying, listen, you know, there's a lot at stake here. And if you think we're in trouble now, look at what a Romney-Ryan presidency would look like. So let's hear from some other folks, I say, Mitch.
Well, we got more people up on the line. And again, you are listening to Pacifica's live coverage of the Republican National Convention with Davey D. and Margaret Prescott. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and the number is 1-800-958-9008. You can also hit us up on email by emailing us at conventions@pacifica.org. Let's go to your neck of the woods, Margaret. Santa Barbara, well, I suppose it's just kind of your neck of the woods. And Santa Barbara, we're joined by Marge. Good evening, Marge.
Hi, good evening. I just wanted to bring up that we never really dealt with the problem of privately owned computers that count the votes. They were made and run by Republicans like Diebold and Sequoia, for example. And I think it's really important that people vote, because if the exit polls are really, really different from the vote, you know, they won't be able to get away with it. And, you know, that's how we can tip the scales if they do flip-flop the votes, manipulating those computers, hacking into them like they've done in the past. And I just wanted to bring that point up and see what you guys have to say about that.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, the whole thing about the computers and all that, we've had a good 8 years to get on board with that, and I don't think that's happened.
Right.
And that's not by mistake. I think that's by design.
Mm-hmm.
What I would say is that people should look at things locally. I always stress that.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of times we pay attention to the national stuff, and it's true, we're here, this is all national. But a lot of the battle stuff is going to be on in your backyard, and that's a little bit harder mm-hmm. to kind of flip things, you know, than it is on mm-hmm. the national scale.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if people really concentrate on what is locally happening, maybe those numbers that you have alluded to that would maybe overcome the type of skimming that you're afraid of might be able to take place. Mm-hmm. But I think if you're just looking at the top of the ticket, Bomber versus Romney, you're not paying attention to the city council person and the mayor and the police chief and the district attorney and more importantly, the judges that actually rule on these cases that we ultimately bring when these issues come up, then we're going to be paying a price for years and years. And that's what me personally, I'm concerned about those local elections, especially around judges and district attorneys.
Should start demanding a paper trail for our votes. Everybody should demand that. So at least we could prove who we voted for in case they try to steal it that way.
Yeah, you can also take a picture of your thing with your cell phone, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, that's a paper trail these days. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, Marge, I think if we, you know, right now the polls are closed. I don't know if they're going to remain close by the time we get to the election in November. But if it is close and if it does come down to a single state, a single precinct, whatever may happen, this very well could be a big issue once again.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
so anyways, Marge, thank you for the call.
Thank
you. Yeah, no, appreciate it. We got our first email. Again, we are taking emails at conventions@pacifica.org. This is from Erwin Frank. He writes that if the Republicans hold their convention in an ice rink, does that mean they're full of hockey? Actually, I believe the Tampa is a hockey rink originally. Yeah, I know it is. So perhaps they are full of hockey. You know, in fact, conventions normally are now held at hockey rinks, oftentimes also used as basketball courts.
I like the look full of hockey as opposed to full of something else.
So my answer to your question is an affirmative.
Well, when you said hockey, I was thinking Sarah Palin, who was a hockey mom. And so that's what, you know, came to mind. I was like, she's coming, but, well, who knows?
All right. Again, you can get on by giving us a call at 958-9008. We go to Los Angeles. We're joined by Andrew. Andrew, good evening to you.
Yeah, good evening, folks. Thanks for your great coverage, as usual. I think as reasonable thinking people who care about the welfare of our country, we shouldn't underestimate the danger the Republican Party can do to our country if we allow their ticket to take over the presidency of the White House. So I think we should all get our butts in gear and get out and help get our president back into office. And while he's not the perfect president, we shouldn't let the good or the perfect be the enemy of the good here. Thank you very much.
Well, wait, stay there. Are you still there? Andrew?
Yes, I'm still here.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up in that perspective. What surprised me yesterday when I went to the Tea Party event and talking to many of the Tea Party activists there, they weren't thrilled with Romney, but they kind of had the same sentiment in the way of, I mean, obviously from a different political slant, but that Romney's better than Obama, and they want Obama out.
Yeah, but you know, today, many people were like neither one of them, and they were looking at Sherry Hunkla, and they was looking at Jill Stein, Green Party. And so I think, again, voting should be something that people are passionate about. It's a personal thing. You should really be clear and very comfortable and confident with the issues and people that you vote for. And I think nobody should be in lockstep with any party. Those parties should own each and every one. They should earn each and every one of your vote. If Obama wants the vote of this young man or somebody else, he better show up and address him in a way or her in a way that's going to be compelling. And I just think that is ultimately what we should be striving for, and that any candidate who wants people to go to the polls should be pushing for, and to the degree that they don't, then, you know, we pay that price.
Yeah, you know, I always wondered why the alternative parties like the Green Party, they don't use the approach that the Green Party in Europe, for example, has taken, like in Germany, where they've made inroads in local elections and really built up a level of credibility and support where they now are, they have to be reckoned with on a national scale. And, you know, looking at the practicality of that approach as opposed to, well, I'm running for president and not really paying attention to perhaps local elections where gains could be made and then have wider influence. You know, it's just something to think about. And from the point of view of the use of resources on alternative parties that have a lot of good things to say, but how many people are really hearing it?
Andrew, are you still there?
I'm still here. I am a Green Party.
Yeah, what do you think about that?
I am a Green Party member, but I think once again we have to take a really close look at the Republican Party and then what they're proposing, which I think is very would be very damaging to the welfare of the masses of the people of the U.S. And we should put we should be practical about this, not idealists about it, and put our resources where they count. And right now, that's not at the national level. That should be at the local level for the Green Party, alternative parties. But right now, at the top, we should be practical here and get Obama back in, and then go back to work on the local level and on the state level for the alternative parties and build up from there. That's my view.
When we say practical, and we'll take our next call in a second, practical means remembering that at least in terms of the presidency, it's voted by state. If I live in California, it's probably going to be a long time before it's not a quote-unquote blue state. They, you know, whatever number of delegates or electoral votes, it's probably going to go, you know, to the person that is the Democrat. I think it's in those swing states that, you know, that everything is going to make a difference. So if I'm living in a state where it's going to probably move in a particular political persuasion, why not vote for your desires versus something that you think, I don't know, there's just so many people that just frown on the whole notion of, you know, voting the lesser of two evils. You see so much dissatisfaction in a state where they gave Obama two senators, you know, a governor. They gave him a bunch of congresspeople, and you have folks that are sitting there going, wow, people are being deported. They're raiding the marijuana clubs, student loans that are all-time high, all these things that they're dissatisfied with. Why not push for somebody who you feel is really going to be responsive to your desires? Even if they don't win, why not push and make that statement anyway?
All right. Hey, Andrew, thank you so much for your call from Los Angeles. I'm not going to say who I think people should vote for president. I don't buy the argument that Ralph Nader shouldn't have run in 2000. I think everyone does have the right to run, and if you can't win the election, then that's on you. I blame more Al Gore for losing Florida than I ever will.
Well, he lost
Ralph
his whole
Nader.
State. That's
but
what,
I,
that's
but
what
I also think. Well, there it is. But I think Andrew makes a point, you know, and it does come to a practical thing in some of these states. I agree with you about California. It's not likely to go to Romney, but there are some very important states, including here in Florida. I don't think that the Stein, personally, right now, and I like Jill Stein, I've interviewed her, and I like Sherry Hunkela, interviewed her as well, right over here. I think they're all great and worthy candidates, but we just don't see the emergence of a third party candidate ticket right now that's really, I think, going to change anything.
You know, one of the things, I know we want to take another caller. This is Margaret Prescott here. You know, I do a lot of work in international work and in traveling in the global south, but also across the pond, so to speak, in Europe. People always say to me, you know, Margaret, when you all vote for president of the United States, you're really voting for the president of all of us, but none of us really have a say about it. And, you know, they really want to hold all of us to account. I mean, as journalists on the air, you know, we can't, even if we might want to, take a position about who to vote for or not, who not to vote for. But I also wanted to just bring in that global aspect, because I think sometimes we really forget that although the empire, so to speak, may be fading, it's still really in place and has a tremendous influence on what happens in my home island in Barbados or in Haiti or what's happening on the continent of Africa, etc. And we have to keep all of that in mind, you know, when we go to the polls. I mean, it is a big responsibility, and I do agree that anybody who wants to run has the right to run, and people have the right to vote for whoever the heck they want to vote for.
And there's many different parts to that. So foreign policy is determined ultimately by, or at least laws around it. A good part of it is going to be Congress. It's going to be the Senate. It's going to be the judges who decide on things that are very heavily contested. And I think, you know, a lot of people are lazy about that. I mean, we talk about, for example, the Oscar Grant situation and that judge that ran for re-election, Robert Perry, right there in Los Angeles. People are like, we don't need to vote for him. So this is the guy that said, hey, you know what, Johannes Mesley, we're going to give a slap on the wrist. That was somebody who we could have elected. There were district attorneys all around this country that have sat there on their hands as people have been getting shot and killed and beaten up by police that we could have made a difference in. And folks just like, it doesn't matter to me. That's where things start to change. And we have to take that very seriously, not just the presidency, but everybody who has an opportunity to make a decision in a representative democracy. And that's why I'm pretty passionate about. And to the degree that we don't do that, I think that's where we need to find fault with ourselves.
All right. And again, what we're going to be doing this hour, we're going to take this whole hour to talk to folks. So when I bring somebody on, don't hang up immediately. We might ask questions or have a different view or, we're going to discuss it. And that's what we're doing this hour. Lots of things to talk about. I want you to give us a call at 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008. We're also accepting emails at conventions@pacifica.org. Let's go to San Francisco. Paul, good evening. You are on the air.
Hello. Can you hear me?
We sure can, Paul. Go for it.
Hey, Paul.
Hi, this is Paul Kangas in San Francisco. I like this sister's comment at the end there about think globally, act locally. And let me raise a local issue that is local to every city in this country, yet almost nobody knows the phrase. It is a feed-in tariff. I don't know if anybody knows what that is. But this is the concept that is being discussed locally at the grassroots level now in every state in this country. And the reason they're discussing it, because it is the policy that was generated in Germany, invented by a guy named Hermann Scheer, 25 years ago, and it's turned the German economy into the strongest economy in Europe, and it's generated 500,000 jobs. And so it's you can hear it being discussed at local levels in every state in the country, but it hasn't made it to into the media. And what it does is it's a law that pays homeowners for harvesting solar energy. It pays them 54 cents a kilowatt hour, and it's generated a lot of money in Germany. So it's become a big issue across the nation, and it's one of these local issues that never gets out through the incubation process. But
all right, so Paul, what does this mean for the election then? Well, what does this mean for the election?
Here's what it means for the election. Do elections actually change anything? I don't think so. I'm 70 years old. I voted in every election since 1964, and I don't think that if Romney wins, I don't think that the right to legalize abortion is going to be pushed back for a number of reasons. I used to provide illegal abortions in the 60s and, forced me to do it again. It's easy for me to do. I've done it before. I went with my mother to get an abortion. She got an abortion in Butte, Montana when I was 9 years old. So ever since then, I've been providing illegal abortions for people. And so they can't push us back on that issue, no matter who gets elected. Or like the war issue. Look what Obama did. Did he stop the war?
So let me ask you this, Paul. Who are you going to vote?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Who are you voting for? Who do you support?
I'm voting for Jill Stein and Sherry Honkala, simply because I think women's rights are more important than any other issue this country faces. But what are they talking about? If you talk to them, they're talking about the need for a feed-in tariff. Why? Because we want to be able to end the oil wars. And that's what the feed-in tariff does. It ends air pollution. It stops nukes. It's the way the Germans shut down half their nukes. You talk to people in this country, most people don't know the Germans shut down half their nukes in response to Fukushima simply because they were getting so much energy from solar panels, they realized we don't need nukes. And so they're going to...
All right, Paul. Listen, Paul, I appreciate your call. I don't know if anyone has any comment, but maybe let's make a new ground rule here. You could talk about whatever you want, whoever candidate you may want or may not want to vote. But let's try to keep it focused on the election.
Yeah.
We probably need a little bit of focus. So I should have put that out there earlier.
Right. And I just, this is Margaret Prescott. I had a quick comment on, you know, illegal abortions. I mean, it was really a terrible time, you know, for women. And clearly, if the right to an abortion is taken away, you know, women will use any means necessary to take care of it. But it's really dangerous. You know, when I was in a young person doing some babysitting, just over a weekend, a mother that I was babysitting for died. She had two young children, you know, with an illegal abortion. So it really is a very, very serious question here. But we do want people to call in at 800-958-9008, 800-958-9008. We are in Tampa Bay at the RNC, the Republican National Convention.
We're actually at WMNF.
Yeah, well, allegedly we're at
we're here to cover RNC. The RNC.
We're covering the RNC.
But because of the delay in opening, we're actually here.
And indeed, that is the case.
We were unclear as to whether or not we'd be able to get in, and we weren't sure where Tropical Storm Isaac was going to go. And so we thought, to be safe, to make sure we still had this broadcast, we'd come to our fantastic
station.
Yeah,
plus nothing was really happening down at the convention site. I mean, listen, this is like a huge party. People out there should, this is like a huge party for the 1%, okay? Money and power and partying and champagning. And I actually sat on the plane. I sat next to a Bush's brain, this guy.
Rove,
Karl Rove lookalike. You know what I mean? Deeply, you know, Republican. He was busy working. You know, he just wanted to, like, drink coffee and keep on going, right? So there's a lot
of
that going around.
That's how they get ahead of the curve. Let's go to another call. Gigi in Pasadena. Good evening, Gigi. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, you guys. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Oh, great. First of all, I got to say, it is the bomb show. I am a supporter. I've been listening for many, many years. This show was top drawer. I, too, like your first caller. I sat down for 4 o'clock, and here's Ian Masters. I'm going, what's going on? I have never left my seat. I don't even know if my children have had dinner tonight. I really don't. This was so amazing. It was very professionally done. It was very well planned out. It flowed. Second point, and then I'll hop off. Oh, no, I'll stay on in case you want to ask questions. But my second point is, you know, I hear, and when Ian came on, I listen to the show every night, as I do you, Margaret, and all of you there. I listen to your shows. And he's always saying, why can't the Democrats get it together, the Republicans, you know, just always out-mobilize and out, you know, we know the money. Okay. But the thing is, these people feel that they're in a fight for their lives. They feel like they're in a fight for their very existence. I mean, they are literally on fire. And all you have to do to stir the pot is to just use things, you know, like fear tactics, and you throw in a little racism and so forth and so on. And, boy, you've got a whole big fire going on. But my point is,
well, I'll tell you, the events I went to yesterday, I think they see it as a holy war.
Well, yeah, but, you know, the truth of the matter is that they don't have the numbers that match, you know, in many of those places. You take a place like Texas, right, where you might find a packed house of Tea Party people, but when you look at the overall numbers of people who could vote versus the people who do, it's not that high of a number. There's many of us on the other side who just simply won't show up for a variety of reasons. Some it's political.
You know why? Let's face it, I don't even know if this would get on the air, but I tell you what, if those Republicans were saying things like, yeah, we're going to put the blacks back in chains, and while we're at it, we'll throw the browns in chains, if we get in, I mean, if you really knew this, if they said their true agenda, tomorrow we would all be mobilized. These people, and they call it, this year it's politically correct to say the dog whistle. I always call it cold talk, you know, and everything. And it goes out, and thank God it is a fringe group. What is it, 28% or something like that? You know, but the reason that we don't is, I think the closest we came was Trayvon Martin, because that just shook, that rocked our world, because we all did sit back thinking that this kind of thing could not happen in a gated community, you know, in an area like that. And when it did, even my daughter, who barely knows who the president is, calling me in tears. And, you know, it has to be something of value to us. And what it is for them, let's face it, their power is waning, and they're fighting for it.
Well, here's the reality. Record number of black people have been coming out in the last few elections. In the midterm elections, we came out in record numbers. You know, so we didn't need a Trayvon Martin. They get it. The people that aren't necessarily showing up are the quote-unquote middle-of-the-road folks, independent voters, a lot of times who one minute like Obama, the next minute like somebody else. Those are ones that didn't show up. For example, in Wisconsin, it was 40% of the people who were in unions that voted for Scott Walker. Record number of black people came out. They couldn't go anymore. More people came out, black folks, in this Scott Walker recall than they did in Obama in 08. But the numbers weren't there when you had 40% going, you know, it doesn't matter. Either I'm not going to show up or I'm going to go the other way. So there is a soccer mom that's just as apathetic as maybe we perceive Pookie and Ray Ray on the corner who were saying we need to energize. They're showing up at the polls. We've got to figure out what the soccer mom is doing. And maybe it might be this women's issue, or maybe it might be getting over racism, or maybe it's just maybe there's a whole other group of people that have been dumbed down and have become apathetic and no longer care. And it's not just all of us all the time. But I'm going to give props to a lot of our young folks because they have been showing up in the polls and they have made a difference. Mississippi, where they had the personhood amendment, it was sisters out of those predominantly historically black colleges that led the charge and flipped that bill and prevented that from being passed. That was us. We don't give ourselves credit for that, but I will.
I will agree. I agree. But what I am saying is they have one bell that they have to ring. Even those women, I bet you they can get, like they, someone said earlier, those guys can get to their wives by saying, you let these people get in and it's game over for us. Your grandson isn't going to be, they ring one bell, and that bell is white power. They only have one bell that they have to ring. Believe me. They only have,
and they're ringing it. Yeah, and they are ringing it. Thank you so much, and thanks for your comments on the show, by the way.
All right, we got another email here, and thank you for that call, Gigi. All right, we're gonna keep moving on. We do want to have a discussion. We want to try to get as many people in this as we can. Also enjoying our program is Constant Borquez, who writes, "Great program. You are all speaking to my heart. It is of utmost importance that we continue to state the fact that the Republicans will try to steal this election. It is blatantly clear with voter ID laws around the country. Watch those swing states. Hard to believe that we have come to this." And again, you can email us as well at conventions@pacifica.org, and the number is 1-800-958-9008. We're now going to go to the next caller, Beth in Berkeley. Good evening, Beth. You are on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say this is a great program to have. Finally, it's nice to see somebody talking about politics for a change. And I wanted to recommend something to everyone, if I could. UC Berkeley. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, UC Berkeley campus has something that I heard about this on the news today, that the students have gotten together to help people decide who to vote for, and it's supposed to be nonpartisan, and it's done by the students. And what you give them certain information, and it tells you who to vote for to economically benefit you the most as an individual. Because they figured too many people were voting because this guy's more handsome than the other guy, or this guy has such and such background and not this guy. And they thought maybe it was time that we voted for the right reasons. And it sounded to me like a pretty good idea.
Well, that might be something to look at. I mean, my experience with the Cal students is that many of them were quite concerned. UC Berkeley, where I went to school, many of them are pretty upset about the student hikes, you know, the tuition hikes, 300%. And I think many of them are fired up around, you know, who's going to lower that. It becomes a challenge because a lot of times we play it as a red versus blue or left versus right thing. But in California, it ain't always the red people that's running around saying, let's raise the tuition. It's quite a few corporate-owned Democrats that are behind it. And that's where people are confused. They're sitting there like, well, that is the Democrat, but he's also for privatizing the university or raising these tuitions. So where do I go? And that's where maybe we have to look at a third party is how some people are concluding.
We need to look deeper into what the person's, maybe even just their voting history. Like, what did they vote for in the past? Did they want to increase taxes or increase costs up to students? Because people really, I mean, what's the future going to be if everybody's totally in debt?
Well, I think a big problem is that money, so much money is now in these elections. Many people are selling out their principles, even if they have been elected by people in a majority who feel that they should be that they should do right by those folks. Corporate dollars have dictated some of those politicians to move in another direction, and that's a big problem.
Exactly. Why don't we make it so that they're free? Give them all the free TV time they want, do all that stuff, so that it doesn't cost anything. You don't owe anybody. You know, that'd be great.
Well, good point. Good point.
Yeah, this is Margaret Prescott here. I actually want to put out a challenge to the listeners. I mean, I know it's a little late on the East Coast, but it really would be great to hear from some of you. You know, I used to live in New York City for a while, you know, after coming from the Caribbean, and we'd like to hear from some of you at 800-958-9008, 800-958-9008. And you New Yorkers and some folks on the East Coast, I know some of y'all stay up really late. We'd love to hear from you.
Well, of course, it is 11:30 at night, but we would certainly love to hear from you. Another email, and again, you can send us your emails at conventions@pacifica.org. This is from Danny Rogers. I have a new word which describes much of what is said in political circles. It is spin formation. I think it describes much of what we hear in partisan politics. It's hard to take anything you hear as an actual fact. The golden rule for anything you hear should be, quote, consider the source. Well, we do have some
spin
more.
Spinfocation.
Let me see it again. It's spin formation.
Spin formation.
Spin formation.
Okay.
Took a minute. Harvey in Oakland. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Yes. I'm calling from Oakland, and it's interesting you guys are in Tampa. I was able to call the local 848-4425 number, which I have programmed onto my speed dial. It seems to work. But what I wanted to say was about Paul Ryan. He's a big fan of Ayn Rand, but she wouldn't be a fan of him because people forget that she was not only an advocate of economic freedom, but also of personal freedom. She denounced Ronald Reagan because of his opposition to abortion. That was in the New York Times op-ed a couple of weeks ago.
Fair enough. It's true.
Yeah.
She had some other issues like selfishness and greed. Human beings are really about that.
But all those progress in her view.
Her stand in favor of personal freedom.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. By the way, I just wanted to give our listeners here a little update coming in on the wires right here. Is that Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal asked President Obama for more Tropical Storm Isaac aid. That's interesting because President Obama declared a state of emergency in Louisiana today. And then Bobby Jindal, you know, turned around and in a phone call asked for more federal aid. And, you know, Mitch and Davey, it's always interesting, people who go on about small government, right? Mm-hmm. And then when there is a disaster, they're like, where is the government? Give me big government. We need help. And, I just wanted to announce that. Yeah.
So. Well, this hurricane thing, if you just look at it purely as a political thing, this is actually an opportunity for Obama with this hurricane coming. I mean, he could be on the ground. He could be talking about what happened in New Orleans in 2005 is not going to happen again. And, of course, you also have to mobilize those resources. But if, you know, God forbid, something tragic is to happen with Hurricane Isaac, and if the government actually mobilizes in an effective way, and, you know, it's an election year, it could be a great way, I would say, for Obama to separate himself from Republicans.
Well, what a tragic way to, you know, to have to do it, you know, with all the money also pouring in into this election. They could spin anything anyway.
We've had a ton of natural disasters, and I think, you know, how he's responded to that, you know, does it weigh? Has it made a difference? Do people remember? I mean, we've had the BP oil spill. We've had those rash of tornadoes.
Yep.
We had those floods in the Midwest. I think, you know, people either they're going to like you and they're going to perceive you as being somebody who's done right by them, or they're just not, no matter what you do. I mean, there were people that were bailed out and that were helped out and that that you know, got his attention. And they turned around and went Tea Party. And then there are other groups of people that have been sitting there going, what's the agenda for us? And he hasn't talked about it at all. And, yeah. You know, so, you know, with black folks, you know, it's like, what's the agenda? Like, I'm not going to talk about that. But let me go give these people a bailout over here. And then the next thing you know, midterm elections, they're like, we're going to Tea Party you up. And so it's, you know, I don't think it would make a difference at the end of the day. I mean, he should do right because it's the right thing to do, no matter what the political consequence is.
But it's all politics. I mean,
it's
to
always
say that
politics.
This isn't about politics and trying to form your message to get reelected and to maintain power.
Well, his message should have been very directly to the people that put him in office in a way that they feel connected the way some of these Tea Party folks feel connected to whoever it is that they voted for. If I go to a lot of these students that came out in record numbers in 08, many of them aren't going to those swing states to volunteer their time. And when you ask them, and I do ask them, they're like, that man hasn't been around. He hasn't done nothing for me. Now, maybe he has, but that's not been communicated to them in a way that makes them feel like, okay, we're part of this scenario, and that's something just to think about.
Well, this is no question, and as you quoted about the John Boehner story earlier, hoping that, I read the full article on it, and he was saying that he doesn't believe black or brown folks will vote for Republicans. He also said he doesn't believe black or brown folks will come to the polls because they don't think that Obama has done anything for them either, especially with the current economic situation.
Well, I think, you know, there's something to be said for that. But I think we'll see what happens in those swing states. That's where it's all going to count. What's going to happen in Ohio? What's going to happen in Florida where we're at? What's going to happen in North Carolina where we're going to? What's going to happen in Michigan? What's going to happen in Wisconsin where Paul Ryan was picked? Those are going to be states that's going to make the difference in the election because it's going to be all about the electoral college. And, you know, to those folks, they may have a very different take than where we have, you know, us being from California or New York or some of the, you know, places that are pretty steep in a particular political persuasion at the end of the day when it comes to voting on national election. We're going to go blue, California. We can count on that. But it might be different for somebody who's in Ohio or Wisconsin this time, and they may have a very different take on the president, or they may have a very different take on Mitt Romney and his partner that's running.
Let's go to our next caller, Elizabeth in Petaluma. Good evening, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Sounds like she's on.
Well,
it
sounds like we have
a
Elizabeth, call back. We could try to get you on, but we were unable to understand what you were saying. So give us a call back. Again, we are taking calls. We still have about 15 minutes left. 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008. Or email us at conventions@pacifica.org. Pat in Whittier. Good evening, Pat. You're on the air.
Good evening. I'm going to thank my Pacifica station with a contribution for your programming today. It's been excellent. I would like to say I'm a left-leaning in politics. I'm registered as a Green member. My vote is hinged on a couple of things. As you've mentioned, in California, we have the luxury of voting after the media has picked the presidential winner, so that might influence my vote. If President Obama follows Joseph Biden and his pledge that he will not touch Medicare at all and Social Security at all, I might go for that. But honestly, I think we have an issue that supersedes all other issues as important as they are, and that is the rapid movement we have towards robotic and semi-robotic warfare. The use of drones and now military robotic soldiers that are being sought after by the DOD removes the human consciousness
from the law enforcement and war efforts. And in a society in which that takes place, I think we are all at risk. And so regardless of what party you end up voting for, what individual you end up voting for, I think it's critical that we stay with the movement politics and that we make sure that the Occupy Wall Street anniversary is celebrated at all the locations where we had Occupy movements. I will be at my local one where I was before.
Well, that's real talk. I think, you know, I mean, Medea Benjamin, who we had on earlier, talks, you know, quite passionately, and she's written quite extensively about that detachment when you have, you know, the quote-unquote drone warfare and the roboticizing of war is something that we should be scared, because it's like, you know, playing a video game. You know, you press a button, you kill 15 people, and you go home, and you don't necessarily think about it, or, you know, at least the public is not outraged. And I think... war is horrific. Death, you know, is horrific, and we should all be detached emotionally so that if that ever happens, it doesn't come easy and it weighs on our consciousness to the point that we don't want to repeat it unless it's at, you know, the last resort.
I think
I have another email here.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I think we need this debate. The debate hasn't taken place in the media outside of Medea, and I'm so appreciative for all her work and support her completely. And in politics, neither one of our major parties have addressed this issue. We need to have this debate. Going forward, we just have to have the debate. It's too big of a threat to society globally. Thank you again.
All right, I appreciate your call. Yeah, no, I thank you for your call and your nice words. Another email, and this actually in the email address is from a phone number. So I won't. Oh no, this is from Lisa. Here it is. Lisa says, critics say Obama hasn't done enough for economy. If true, it's because Congress has had too many Republicans, and especially the first and second years, blue dog Democrats. We must both reelect Obama and give him a better Congress to work with. That should be the progressive message now. And next time, get involved by primary season. Then we'll have even better options in the general election.
All righty. Thank you, Lisa. Again, disturbing story. I just wanted to use the opportunity here to report. There is a story out. It has not yet been picked up by mainstream media about Army soldiers allegedly plotted to kill President Obama. And it's reported that a state prosecutor said on Monday that four U.S. soldiers had secret roles in a militia that planned to take over Fort Stewart Army Base in Georgia. This is according to reports by the Associated Press, and to kill the president.
And so, they already killed somebody who they thought was going to confess to that.
Right, and to leak information about what they were up to. So this is a story very much under the radar, but, you know, really disturbing.
And this goes hand in hand with the recent mass shooting of the guy that was in the Army, you know, and was shooting up folks. And
the Sikh temple.
Yeah, so, you know, these things are happening, and... you know, we don't look at what's motivating this. What are we doing to stop this? A lot of it is fueled by racism. A lot of it is fueled by the blacking and browning of the country. But it's also a lot of people who've got it into their head that government is their enemy, and they look at this particular administration as one that needs to be confronted in a very militaristic way. We forget there was that guy, Joseph Stack, who flew the plane into the IRS building in Texas. We forget that when we were at the Democratic Convention in 08, there were folks that had made threats against then-President Obama, I mean, candidate Obama. So, you know, this is something that has been happening that you didn't necessarily see with other presidents. And we look at it, we look at Obama in isolation and forget that that rage may center on him but play itself out on us. Maybe that's why we're seeing so many people being shot by police. If they're joining the Army, they might be joining these police forces and then just shooting black and brown youth. Or it might be showing up in the laws that they pass, these anti-immigration laws. And so the anger that some are feeling because of... people who are quote-unquote different from them is not something to take lightly, and hopefully we can all move in a direction that makes people feel whole versus the type, you know, versus feeding into this anger that I think is put many of us on the short end of a stick, economically and physically.
Well, that's a crazy story you just brought to us, Margaret.
Is that something?
Thank you for that. Well, listen, we only have about about 7 minutes to go. Let's try to get through as many calls as we can. Sam in Alhambra. Sam, good evening. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes. Is this Sam?
Yes.
Sam, you're on the air.
I'm sorry. Yeah, my idea is that there's a way that we can split the difference, so to speak, in terms of the election. Speaking particularly to the situation with swing states, my experience having some door knocking for Democratic candidates is that there is information that's given to you as a volunteer. You knock on the door, and you basically just ask, okay, are you planning on voting for this candidate? And then you remind them, well, election day is on November 4th, blah, 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 and that's it. And then one tabulates this information, and eventually this information just makes its way back to the Democratic headquarters of the region. If people are going to be door knocking for the Democratic candidate for president in these swing states, as perhaps they should, given the particular situation that we're in, being that the left has very little power institutionally. And,
Sam, we got to get to the point quickly.
Weak compared to the left in countries like Spain or France, that we use this opportunity to work for the Democratic campaign while also collecting information for some local grassroots organization that is actually progressive.
So you have a dual strategy there. It sounds like a dual strategy, Sam.
Sam,
I'm going to leave it right there because we got a number of more callers and we only have about 6 minutes to go. Let's go to Mishwa in San Francisco. Mishwa, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Great program. My main comment is that it's really impossible for third parties, fourth parties, fifth parties, parties other than the two mainstream parties to make any kind of headway in state or national elections. In many countries, let's say a particular party gets 3% of the vote, then they get 3% of the representatives in Congress. It's not that way here. It's winner take all. So many people, so many voices are shut out of the process, and I think that's part of the reason why people don't vote, because it's rigged. It's set up for the two-party system, which is operates really like a one-party system. We have to remember that Obama raised more money from Wall Street than the Republican candidate, who I don't even remember who, I can't even remember his name off the top of my head in 2008.
John McCain.
And so he's beholden to those types of forces that are dominating our nation. And there are, like, the Green Party does do local elections. Look at the mayor of Richmond who's having to stand up to Chevron. And thank God there's a Green Party mayor of Richmond. So we need
have
to
more.
Figure out ways to increase participation in ways that allow third parties to actually have representation.
All right, Mishwa, thank you very much for that call. We're running out of time. I want to try to squeeze a couple of more callers in. Who was I just looking at here? We have a caller from Seattle, and it is Pam. Good evening,
Seattle,
Pam. You're on the air.
Hi. Just want to encourage people to think about the importance of global climate change and all the jobs that we can create here in Seattle. We're very busy putting up a lot of solar, doing energy efficiency, and we have Obama to thank for it. He gave Seattle $20 million, and we're just retrofitting as many homes, and we're putting an electric highway all the way from the Canadian border down to Mexico, again, thanks to stimulus funds. really making a difference. I can't hire people fast enough to keep my solar business going.
All right. Thank you so much for that call. We're going to take one last caller, and it is Orion in Carson, California, or Carlos in Carson, California. Forgive me. Carlos, are you there?
This is Orion, no Carlos.
Oh, Orion, go ahead.
Orion, I was just calling me. I wanted an answer on why is it the right thing to do to send relief to the hurricane victims, the recent hurricane victims?
Why do you ask it, though? Give me some context.
Well, I heard you guys earlier saying President Obama can make a strong pull by sending relief. But regardless if it's if he does it or not, it is the right thing to do, were the words used.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you not think it's the right thing to do?
I in no way think it's the right thing to do. These people
tell me in 10 seconds why.
Hurricane zone, knowing that they're in a hurricane zone. These people move into Tornado Alley knowing they're moving into Tornado Alley. And then when
so are we all going to...
Don't you live in an earthquake zone?
Damn straight I do. And when an earthquake hits, I am not
okay,
going to
be just
for
this is just silly season. Pull that off. That's silly season. He's not being serious. I mean, that's a wasted call. Of course, you try to save anybody whose life is in danger. Just for people who are, wondering, why would you do that? I mean, if God forbid, if you're in an accident and somebody is in a position to save you, they save you. And if and every one of us that live in this country live in a place that is subjected to some sort of natural disaster. If you live in the Midwest, you may have a hurricane. If you live in Florida, if you live in the Midwest, you may have a tornado. If you live in Florida, you may have a hurricane. If you live in the West, you have tornadoes, blizzards, and heat waves and all that. And wherever there is a situation, we should always be willing to help.
All right, Davey D., thank you for that. And that does it for tonight's broadcast. That's Davey D., also Margaret Prescott. I'm Mitch Cheserich. We'll be back tomorrow with more live coverage from the Republican National Convention. So many people to thank. Our engineers here in the room are John L. Mella and Otis McClay. Our engineers in Berkeley are Jill Montgomery, Michael Yoshida, and Dev Ross. Stephanie Hendricks is our producer back in Berkeley. And our big producer, our executive producer here in Tampa is Nell Abrams. Also, special thanks to WMNF for accommodating us this hour. Am I missing anybody else?
Lisa.
Lisa.
Thank you, Lisa.
And Lisa's last name is Lisa Marzilli. Is that it?
That's it.
I hope you will join us again tomorrow at 8 Eastern, 5 Pacific Standard Time. Thanks for listening.
Festival on Labor Day, Monday, September 3rd.
12 noon to 2 p.m., an afternoon of yoga, music, and play for parents and their kids. This event is a benefit for Jai Beam International's youth projects in the Dalit, ex-untouchable communities in India. $20 per family is requested and will fund our educational and cultural programs this winter. Our family yoga festival will gather at Yoga Tree, 1234 Valencia Street in San Francisco, and is handicap accessible. For more information, call 415-289-2019 or go to www.